Barker, Barnhart, Berger, Beyer, Bonamici, Boone, Boquist, Bruin, Buckley, Burley, Butler, Cameron, Cannon, Clem, Cowan, Dallum, Dingfelder, Chris Edwards, David Edwards, Esquivel, Flores, Galizio, Gerard, Gelzer, Gilliam, Gilman, Gerard, Greenlick, Hannah, Holvey, Hunt, Jensen, Comp, Kotek, Krieger, Crummel, Lim, McPherson, Maurer, Minnis, Morgan, Nathanson, Nelson, Nolan, Olson, Reed, Richardson, Riley, Roblin, Rosenbaum, Schaffler, Scott, Shields, Greg Smith, Patty Smith, Thatcher, Tomei, Wisnet, Witt, Mr. Speaker, excuse for business of the House, Schaffler, Patty Smith.
Colors will be posted by Oregon State University Air Force ROTC. I pledge allegiance to the flag
of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Please go ahead and take your seats. The opening ceremony today will be presented by Professor Kathleen Dean Moore of the Philosophy Department at Oregon State University in Corvallis and the Oregon State University Meistersingers performing a New England folk song, Because They Could Not Sing. Hal Eastburn is the conductor, and they are guests of Representative Sarah Gelser.
Last month, soft rain is sliding down the classroom window. There's sun behind this rain, and it throws rippled light onto my students' faces the way a river throws light into the alders. The air in the classroom smells of wet hair and azaleas. In the third row, a student raises his hand and asks the questions every professor dreads and desperately hopes for. What can we do? I'm afraid of the future, the world wired for self-destruction. Tell me one thing I can do. I sit down on the chair behind the teacher's desk and study my hands. Despair in students is a terrible thing. I say, there is no future. There is this present moment. You will create the future, every decision bringing into existence the next moment, shaping the next world, moment after moment, world after world. From your decisions, the future unfolds. Different decisions will make a different world, foresighted or foolish, generous or unforgivably self-absorbed. I say, for now, learn wildly. If we find a way to preserve a world worth living in, it won't be in a grim winner-take-all war of ideas, but in the wild abundance of ideas and stories and knowledge and wisdom and caring that is our human gift to the world, the great upwelling of the human imagination. I say, do not think you can change the world. You change yourself. Make your life a testimony to what you believe is good and true and right. That will change the world. Remember, you aren't who you say you are. You are what you do. Be the beauty of light behind tall firs. Be the kindness of soft rain. Be the truth of your convictions. Be courage. Be hope.
The miller was drowning, sad. And the weaver got some new yarn. And the devil took the swords and the little tailor with the broadcloth under his arm. Because they could not see. Because they could not see. He rolled his traps fell into his hats. Because they could not see. Because they could not see, because they could not see. Simply roll his shots down to his cups, because they could not see. Remember the days of the mill, the weaver and the because they could not see. Because they could not see. Because they could not see. We rolled his shots down to his hat. Because they could not see. Could not see.
Rarely has a song about those who could not sing be sung so well. That was a wonderful presentation by Oregon State University Meistersingers. Thank you very much. Courtesies, Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, today, as you may have noticed, is Oregon State University Day, and I'd like to introduce you to several of my constituents. The singers are needing to leave right now to go over to sing on the Senate side, but I wanted to tell you a little bit about them. The choir that we just heard from was the OSU Meistersingers. They were founded in 1999 and have created a musical connection across the OSU campus and community. With their bold blend of old college songs and traditional men's music, the Meistersingers have become the most popular traditional choir on campus. This eclectic group of 50 men with majors from A to Z, anthropology to zoology, has a commitment to excellence in singing and building a strong sense of community. The song they performed today was Because They Could Not Sing, which is a New England folk song that was arranged and conducted by Hal Eastburn. Our invocation today, our beautiful invocation, was provided by Kathleen Dean Moore. And Dr. Moore is a distinguished professor of philosophy at Oregon State University, where she was recently named University Writer Laureate. She is the author of books about our cultural and spiritual connections to wet and wild places, most notably River Walking, which contains essays about Oregon rivers from the Willamette to the Grand Ronde, and the Pine Island Paradox. She's the winner of the Oregon Book Award for Creative Nonfiction. At Oregon State, she teaches environmental philosophy and directs the Spring Creek Project for Ideas, Nature, and the Written Word. And her favorite course that she teaches is the Philosophy of Nature, which meets beside Gold Lake in the Oregon Cascades. So thank you for your invocation today. And finally, I wanted to introduce you to one of my more famous constituents over in the side aisle. I hope that you will extend courtesies to Benny the Beaver. He has been cheering on the Oregon State delegation of representatives. He's going to be here to do that for us today. Benny started his work as the OSU mascot all the way back in 1941. He's not tired yet. And ever since, he has been all over the country with OSU teams, cheering them to bowl game victories and national championships. He's very loyal. He enjoys rallying the fans, leading cheers. He has a small behavior problem in terms of taunting other mascots, and he supports the very diverse ventures of Beaver Nation. In his free time, he enjoys sampling Oregon's fine wood products, going to OSU's food science lab, and he also likes to gnaw down trees. Please leave the pillars there, Benny. And he can do that in 7 minutes or less. Please join me in welcoming Benny the Beaver and all of his friends to the Capitol from Oregon State University today. Thank you.
Representative Dahlem.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'm very pleased and would like to introduce to you the 2007 Cherry Festival Sweetheart Court. The first one, and Stephanie, if you'd raise your hand, is Stephanie Larson. She's the daughter of Harry and Mary Jo Larson. Stephanie is on the equestrian team at the Dalles Wetonka High School and has been their captain for 3 years. Next year, she's planning on attending OSU to pursue a career in medical administration. Next is Stephanie Prentice. She's the daughter of Rick Prentice and Donna Bailey. She's on the Dalles Wetonka softball team and played volleyball last fall also. She's planning to attend OHSU and become a paramedic. Lorianne Jones is next, and Lorianne is the daughter of Chris and Nancy Jones. Lorianne loves to be active, is involved in volleyball, basketball, and softball. She plans on attending Linfield College this fall to pursue a career in education and will continue her volleyball and softball career at Linfield. The 2007 Cherry Sweetheart Court is here to help kick off the annual Cherry Festival in the Dalles, which begins next week. It's filled with lots of fun events throughout the week, culminating in a parade, which Dorothy and I will be attending. We ask all of you, come to the Dalles, enjoy the beautiful Cherry Festival. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Welcome, and thank you for the invitation to the Dalles. Representative Krieger.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, would you please join me today in wishing one of my staff persons, Megan, a happy birthday. Today is her birthday. She's 21.
Happy 21st birthday. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I'm pleased to have with me today, and hope you will make welcome my friends. Here on the side aisle on your left is Rick Prissett. He's a city councilor in Lincoln City. And on your right, Dan Beck, who's the chair of the Democratic Central Committee in Lincoln County. Welcome.
Welcome. Good to have you. Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, please join me in extending courtesies of the House to my special guest, my favorite constituent and my best friend, my loving partner, Amy, who's here with me today. Thank you.
Welcome, Amy. Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, it is my pleasure to introduce to you my new intern, Sarah Kate, a third-year student at the University of Oregon. Hope she won't have a problem with my tie, who is also a native of Ashland. Sarah is studying political science and English, and upon completing her studies, she hopes to attend graduate school to receive a master's degree in political science. She is currently doing part of her studies at the Labor Education Research Center. Her hobbies include playing tennis and the piano, and her favorite band is Led Zeppelin. Please join me in extending a warm welcome to Sarah Kate.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. You've probably seen my guest here and a favorite OSU Sea Grant fellow, Ephraim Temple. He's assisting our Coastal Caucus this session. He will be graduating this June in Fisheries Science with a minor in Marine Resources Management. And he is originally from Hawaii, one of 10 children. He's married. He has 2 children. And, you know, as we all know how hard it is to go to college on your own, put together with that, working here at the legislature full-time in addition. So please welcome Ephraim and go Beavs.
Representative Maurer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As an alumnus of Oregon State University, I'd like to take this opportunity to honor someone who is not a graduate of OSU. As you may recall, a number of weeks ago, OSU challenged all 90 legislative offices to take the OSU quiz. The quiz consisted of 11 questions about the state's land-grant institution, for who was the mascot the precede of Benny Beaver, to what energy source is OSU developing to produce electricity. The answers were due last Friday. Today I have the privilege of acknowledging 2 legislators who answered 10 of the 11 questions correctly. under the rules of the quiz. However, in case of a tie, the legislator who submitted her answer first would be deemed the winner. The winner of the quiz, the most prompt and knowledgeable legislator about Oregon State University, is my distinguished colleague from House District 51, representing the Clackamas area, including Beaver Creek. Please join me now in recognizing State Representative Linda Flores. And join us all at 5 o'clock this evening in the Galleria, where OSU President Ed Ray will acknowledge Representative Flores for her accomplishment. Please also join me acknowledging our Corvallis colleague from House District 16. Representative Gelser also answered 10 of the 11 questions correctly, although she answered them a little later. Finally, let us acknowledge a third colleague from Central Oregon House District 54, Representative Chuck Burley. Representative Burley was the winner of the first round of the OSU quiz last year. For those of you who are interested in the quiz, and especially the answers that are provided by email to your offices last evening, I have a copy of the answers at my desk if you have any questions. Thank you.
Representative Reed.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I hope you'll help me welcome two constituents, Esther Griffin and Wayne Schmidt, who are here to observe our activities today. Thank you.
Representative Crummell.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I would like to introduce a constituent slash intern for the day in my office. Sitting here at my desk is Anthony Brady. Anthony is from the Cornelius area. He is a ninth grader who is homeschooled. He really enjoys basketball. I see OSU in the future, maybe. And he works every Tuesday over on the Senate side with Senator Bruce Starr. He also likes history, geography, and politics. And so that's it. So welcome, Anthony, to the House, and thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Nolan.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker and colleagues. I'd like to introduce to you my legislative assistant for the day, a person who is a constituent of mine, but more importantly, someone who is a mentor of mine and has helped me understand why it is important what we do in this building. Terry Bean.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I hope you'll join me in extending courtesies to a former candidate for the House. And my friend Lee Coleman is here on the side aisle joining us today. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Are there further courtesies? Messages from the governor. Messages from the Senate.
Mr. Speaker, I'm directed by the President to inform you that he has signed Senate Bill 83.
First reading memorials and resolutions. Standing committee reports. The committee report file has been distributed. Special committee reports. Special orders of business. Before I ask the clerk to read the first bill, I want to remind members and to remind the public in the galleries that it is not appropriate to exclaim or applaud or make audible comments on these issues here in the protocol of the House. So if you do have a desire to make such expressions, please take them outside the doors into the lobby. Thank you. Clerk will read the bill.
House Bill 2007 relating to same-sex relationships.
The question now rises upon third reading and final passage of House Bill 2007A. Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, we work together every single day. Like you, I put in the long hours and sit here on the floor doing the people's business. Most of you know me as Representative Kotek from North Portland, who works on healthcare issues, human services, children's issues. Today, I ask you to acknowledge me as the person who works closely with you, as well as for who I am, Tina Kotek, who has a loving partner named Amy. As a lesbian in a loving, committed relationship, I experience my life as a second-class citizen, pretty much every day. The passage of House Bill 2007 will correct this inequity. Colleagues, at the end of each day, and for some of us at the weekend, we go home to our families. We sit down at the dinner table and talk over the day's events. We probably sit down and do some bills, maybe watch some TV. Many of us go home to wives and husbands. Some of us have adorable children. I go home to my loving partner, Amy. We're no different from other couples in many ways. We support each other in good times and in bad times. As you know, I recently experienced a great loss when my mother passed away, when she became unexpectedly ill. And for many of you who have lost a parent, you know what a hole in your heart that leaves. And nothing helps you heal better than having loving family nearby. And for me, that loving family was my partner, Amy. She was my rock and my comfort in a very difficult time. Yet Amy and I differ greatly in how we are treated under Oregon law. We're treated differently from other committed couples who are able to access hundreds of protections, rights, and responsibilities through the contract of marriage. Under Oregon law, Amy and I are barred from having any legal relationship with or responsibility to each other. We have no legal right to bereavement or sick leave. We have no legal assumed inheritance rights, as married couples do. And although we own a home together, we cannot file our joint state tax returns. I'll be very honest with you. This is unbelievably unfair and, many days, just downright scary. No matter how many hundreds of dollars we spend to prepare a bundle of legal paperwork that might protect us in certain limited situations, the blunt truth remains that Amy and I are nothing but strangers in the eyes of Oregon law. The tragedy of losing my mom so quickly was very eye-opening. As you know, anything in life can happen. You can get sick at any time. And if I were to become ill, I would want Amy by my side taking care of my medical care. And if anything happened to Amy, I would definitely want to be at her side, making sure her needs were met. In most fundamental human ways, the legal recognition of our relationship really matters. Amy and I think a lot about our future together. We plan on raising children. We're both going to be great parents. But under the law, only one of us will be recognized as a parent. Colleagues, how would you like not to be recognized as a parent of your children? Does this make any sense whatsoever? Why deny some Oregonians such protections when, as legislators, we strive to give Oregonians every possible tool to be successful and self-sufficient? My friends, on the best days, we get to legislate in ways that support stronger families and a stronger Oregon. Please, make today one of those days. By passing House Bill 2007 and instituting comprehensive, legally recognized domestic partnerships for same-sex couples, you will provide security, comfort, and peace of mind to my family, as well as to families just like mine and every community in Oregon. Thousands of Oregonians and their families' lives will be made better by your vote today. I ask for your yes vote for the sake of my family, colleagues. And I thank you for the sake of other loving couples all across the state of Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, it is my great honor to join in bringing you House Bill 2007A, the Oregon Family Fairness Act, which comes to you from your House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules, and will establish domestic partnerships in Oregon. It will ensure that those in a domestic partnership have the legal right to visit a partner in the hospital and to be party to end-of-life decisions. It will protect children who have already lost one parent from being told that they will have to say goodbye to the other.
The Oregon Family Fairness Act recognizes that there is a strong state interest in asserting the basic dignity and sanctity of all families. Every family is unique. Some have kids, some have pets, some move around a lot, some stay in the same home for generations, some have two parents, and some have one. And some involve people of the same sex who have made a serious lifelong commitment to one another. At the end of the day, your I vote on the Oregon Family Fairness Act will be a vote to protect and strengthen more Oregon families. It will be a vote to confer dignity to people whose loved ones are facing the worst life has to offer, things like illness, incapacitation, and death. It will be a vote to remove legal insecurity from people preparing for the best life has to offer, like the birth of a child or a new professional opportunity. Your I vote will not give anyone special rights, but it will affirm the basic humanity of our friends, families, neighbors, and colleagues, and honor the role that family plays in everyone's life. Families are the people with whom we celebrate, the people with whom we mourn. Our families are the people from whom we derive our values and our identity. We may be discussing a divisive issue right now, but I know one thing that everyone in this chamber has in common. We're not getting any younger. And as each year passes, as the bottom line importance of family in my life comes into better perspective, it becomes more and more difficult for me to imagine a legal reality whereby only certain families are deemed worthy of legal status. Colleagues, there are people in our communities who need a piece of legislation to be able to be in the room as their spouse draws their last breath. There are people in our communities who need a piece of legislation to have the right to see their children. These are people who need us today to demonstrate the moral courage to recognize that their families count. And that is why I ask you to join me in voting aye on House Bill 2007A, the Oregon Family Fairness Act. Thank you, and I look forward to your questions.
Further discussion? Representative Richardson.
Question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier. Does Carrie yield?
I do.
She does.
I refer you and have a question about information that's contained in the bill on page 2 at the top, starting with line 5, where it says, without the ability to obtain some form of legal status for their relationships, same-sex couples face numerous obstacles and hardships in attempting to secure rights, benefits, and responsibilities for themselves and their children. Many of the rights, benefits, and responsibilities that the families of married couples take for granted cannot be obtained in any other way than through state recognition of committed same-sex partnerships. Is that the intention of this bill, to help rectify the wrong and the discrimination that's taking place against same-sex partnerships?
Thank you, Representative, for that question. I would say that is not the only purpose of this bill. It would certainly be one purpose of this bill.
Follow-up question?
Follow-up question is Carrie Yield.
I do.
She does.
On page 3 of the bill, section 4, it says, the following domestic partnerships are prohibited and void, and then subsection B, when the parties to the domestic partnership are first cousins or any nearer of kin to each other. Now, my question is, if there are two sisters who never married, who are elderly, and they live together and love each other in a loving relationship, but they're not lesbian, would they also have the benefit of domestic partnerships which are promised to same-sex couples?
No, Representative, not under the language of this bill.
Follow-up question?
Follow-up question is Carrie Yield.
I will.
She does.
There are many instances where, because of a bad marriage, a woman must leave the marriage and look to her family for help. In a situation where a mother takes in her adult daughter who's been in a bad marriage, she may have even children, but now the adult daughter is living with the mother, has a loving relationship, has the needs for these same benefits that have been so eloquently stated by both of the representatives carrying this bill. Would that loving relationship of the same sex have the benefits of domestic partnerships under this bill?
No representative, it would not under the language of this bill.
Final question?
Additional question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield? She does.
Notwithstanding the fact that the bill specifically states that it relates to same-sex couples, in a situation where you have a mother whose adult son lives with her and that he's never married, and yet she's very dependent upon him and he's dependent on her, and they would desire to have the same benefits that are promised to same-sex couples in this bill, can you tell me why they should be deprived of those benefits?
Representative, the intention of this bill is to allow for those domestic partners who do not have currently under law the right to any legal protection or legal relationship to have the benefit that is accorded a domestic partnership under this bill. The situations you're proposing all have various kinds of legal relationships right now. That is not the intention of House Bill 2007.
Thank you. To the bill?
To the bill.
Mr. Speaker and colleagues, of course, two same-sex couples that are living together also have legal rights that they can call upon if they want to have rights relating to medical procedures. They can have general powers of appointment, which are durable in nature. There are wills. There are trusts that can be established. There's many rights under the law which protect two individuals who would like to have the benefit of those rights. House Bill 2007 also states in part, any privilege, immunity, right, or benefit granted because the individual is married is granted on equivalent terms to an individual because the individual is in a domestic partnership. That's wording out of Section 9, subparagraph 1. So House Bill 2007 essentially creates special rights for gay and lesbian couples, but discriminates against other couples who also would have every desire to have a loving relationship, have that kind of relationship, and have the need of benefits relating to health, visitation, finances, inheritance. All of the benefits that can be claimed by a same-sex couple would be of great benefit to a couple of sisters who love each other, who are deprived under this bill from the rights of being able to have the benefits of the domestic partnership. It would also apply in the case of a mother with an elderly daughter. It would also apply for an elderly mother and her son. Why would it be appropriate to say that this is about stopping discrimination when, in fact, it merely creates special rights for one subgroup and deprives those rights of others who have every right and qualification for those same benefits, excepting for the fact that they're not gay or lesbian? House Bill 2007A had the opportunity to be amended to incorporate in it reciprocal benefits, which spelled out benefits for all couples who are in a loving relationship but deprived from the opportunity to be married. It's a long bill. It specifically spells out approximately 250 out of the less than 500 statutes that relate to marriage, husband and wives, or spouses. There's that many statutes that state one of those words. But the 250 or so benefits that are spelled out in House Bill 3536, the Reciprocal Benefits Bill, provided those benefits to all couples who can't be married, who are in a loving relationship, and does not discriminate in favor based solely on sexual orientation. House Bill 2007 is, in fact, marriage by another name. House Bill 2007 is a bill to create special rights for gay and lesbian couples based on their sexual orientation while discriminating against other couples such as the elderly sisters, the mother and her daughter, or the mother and her son. And that type of discrimination has no place in this chamber. If the goal is merely to give benefits based on sexual orientation, that's one thing. But let us remember that there is an opportunity for the bill to be expanded and to provide benefits for all couples that have a loving relationship but not base it on sexual orientation.
Further discussion, Representative Greg Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, this is an emotionally charged issue before us today. And no amount of fact or no amount of motion, no matter what I say, no matter what the good representative from Southern Oregon says, no matter what the carriers of the bill say, we're not going to change our opinion. We know where we are on this legislation today. So what I want to do is to share my thoughts with you. And if I get emotional, because I truly am about to speak based upon the faith that I hold close to me. And if that offends, I apologize. There is no place in this state for discrimination. We need kindness. We need compassion. We need love for every citizen in the state of Oregon. After all, in my view, we're all children of God. I want you to know, to some of you, these may be words. Sometimes actions speak louder than words. In my office, I've employed a lady whose spouse is a transgender individual who would come into my office on a regular basis. Didn't take away from the fact that she was a fabulous employee. I've had employees who are homosexual. They showed up to work every single day, did their job, went home, and lived their life. But colleagues, in my mind, and this is on my personal belief, I'm not able to justify or rationalize what I believe is an immoral act. And I share with you, if my son came home to me, or my daughter came home to me and said, "Dad, I want to share with you that I'm a homosexual or that I'm lesbian," I would not love him or her any less. I'd wrap my arms around him or her, and I'd do all I could to embrace my son or my daughter. But I want you to know what my view is and what I believe in my heart. And that is, I believe there's a difference between what one is and what one does. In my view, while my son may deserve unlimited tolerance and love and compassion, in my view, again, his act, if that was what he was to bring home, would not warrant me tolerating with yet only a measured amount. Colleagues, I want you to know what I believe. Today, no matter what I say, some of you will find offensive, just as what others say I may find offensive. What's so wonderful about this House floor is the fact we can get on this floor and say what is in our heart and what is in our mind. And then we, as representatives of the people of Oregon, and we, as representatives with conscience, can vote the way we feel we need to. Colleagues, I believe that all men and women are children of God. I believe that the first commandment of God that he gave to Adam and Eve pertained to the potential for parenthood as husband and wife. And that God's first commandment was to multiply and replenish the earth. And I believe that procreation is sacred and it's to be conducted within the bounds of matrimony by a husband and wife. I believe that husbands and wives have a solemn obligation to love each other. I believe that children are a heritage of the Lord. I believe that parents have a sacred duty to rear their children in love and righteousness
and to provide for their physical and spiritual needs, to teach them to love one another, and to teach them to love their neighbors. I also believe that husbands and wives will be held accountable for the way they raise their children.
Representative Morgan yields.
Thank you, Representative. Very close to me, I believe that the family is the foundation of our society and that it is ordained of God. I believe that marriage is an essential part of our Heavenly Father's plan. To those of you who had asked me to change what I believe in, those of you who would want me to concur with House Bill 2007, to those who would want me to tolerate House Bill 2007, I just want to share with you, there are some of us in this chamber. We may not be the vocal majority today, but there are some of us in this chamber who view homosexuality in all of its forms as a sin. As a sin. And the fact is, I cannot change who I am. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion, Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill?
To the bill.
Colleagues, as I've mentioned on this floor before, I've spent about 25 years of my adult life working in the theater. I've worked side by side with a number of gay and lesbian individuals, and I have a shocking truth to tell you. They're just like anybody else. They do their best to do good work. They do their best to be good people. They do their best to take care of the people that they love. If you'll indulge me for just a minute, I'd like to tell you a tale of two families. Just about 20 years ago, I was going through the experience that our colleague from the center of Portland is going to go through in a little while. I was a new father trying to figure out how to take care of a baby, how to be a good parent. And my friends and neighbors were a lesbian couple. I had met one of the partners during the course of my work, and we raised our kids together. We figured it out. Together. We shared supplies. We cooked for each other. We babysat for each other so that we could all work and earn money so we could take care of our families. And during a period of time, colleagues, that was, without a doubt, the darkest stretch of time for my family that I've experienced thus far, with the death of my oldest brother and my father within 2 weeks of each other of cancer, a very difficult birth of our second son, and a life-threatening illness for my oldest son. Throughout that time, our friends stayed with us every step of the way. They cooked for us. They cared for us. They counseled us. Soon after that, one of my friend's moms was taken ill and facing death. And we tried our best to do the same for our friends. We cooked for them. We cared for them. We counseled them. But colleagues, it was very clear to me, very, very clear to me, that the same rights and support that my family had as we moved through the crisis we faced, the same rights and support that I take for granted, were not available to my dear friends. And colleagues, that's unacceptable to me. Now, my community, the city of Ashland, believes it's important to encourage and reward committed monogamous relationships, regardless of the sexual orientation of the partners. That's why we established a registry to recognize same-sex commitments in public record. And even though what we did didn't provide any additional legal rights or protections, couples were eager to sign up. Same-sex couples want to demonstrate their commitment to one another just like straight couples do. It's no difference. And that was a first step in a path that leads us to where we are today. Now, opponents of this bill have said very little about it over the last few weeks. Why? Because I think they know that when Oregonians ask themselves, why should we pass this bill? The answer is, why shouldn't we? Why wouldn't we, in the spirit of fairness and in support of families, allow same-sex couples to obtain similar protections and responsibilities as those you and I take for granted? Why wouldn't we do all that we can to ensure that children in our state have a legal relationship to the parents who plan for them, who care for them. Why wouldn't we allow our fellow Oregonians who have been in committed same-sex relationships for 20, 30, 40 years to choose the final resting place for their beloved? Why wouldn't we ensure that all Oregonians can utilize Oregon's family leave laws to care for a sick child, domestic partner, or the parent of a domestic partner? Why wouldn't we allow those closest to our gay and lesbian friends and neighbors to stand at their partner's sides at the hospital? Why wouldn't we ensure they can weigh in on important medical decisions for the people that they have committed their lives to? Now, there's a reason that opponents of the bill haven't given answers to these questions, because good answers to those questions simply do not exist. The real question before us today is, why must we act today on this critical legislation? The answer goes back to how I began this statement. I believe that part of our job as legislators is to ensure that Oregon families have every tool available to them to care for family members every day, particularly in times of crisis. But the truth is, colleagues, that some families in Oregon have more tools than others. Like straight couples, committed same-sex couples are emotionally and economically interdependent. They're sharing household and financial responsibilities. They're often raising children and taking care of other family members together. A significant number, like my friends.
Representative Chris Edwards yields.
Thank you, Representative Edwards. A significant number, like my friends, are raising children. Yet these couples and their families, without the establishment of a legal relationship to one another, lack critical protections to support their families in times of crisis, to allow committed partners to care for one another and keep children and families safe from harm. Well, as it has been mentioned, there are a limited number of protections available currently through legal arrangements. These options are costly and they fall short of the full spectrum of protections that my family enjoys. Now, this bill would allow same-sex couples and their family more than 500 protections, not 250, not half the protections that my wife and I enjoy, not half the protections that my family enjoys, but all the protection that my family enjoys. Many of these things that we just take for granted, such as the right to take bereavement or sick leave to care for a partner or a partner's child, to choose a final resting place, to make life-saving medical decisions, to obtain wrongful death benefits for a surviving partner and children, to have joint custody, visitation, adoption, foster care, to transfer property and assets from partner to partner if she or he doesn't have a valid will, to obtain joint health, home, and auto insurance policies, to enter into joint rental agreements, to get an equitable division of property in case of a divorce, and the joy of filing joint tax returns. Ladies and gentlemen, I believe it's time to make sure that our friends, our neighbors, our co-workers, our fellow citizens, people that I know and I love, are as equal as possible under the laws of our state. We have a historic opportunity. Why wouldn't we seize it? When I vote today, colleagues, I'm voting on behalf of a very basic principle, that every Oregon family deserves protection, and every Oregonian deserves the same civil rights. And when I vote today, colleagues, I am voting to celebrate and honor the friendship, the love, and the care of my dear friends. Thank you.
Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I rise today fully recognizing the historic significance in this giant leap forward for fairness in our state. But this moment for me is bittersweet. While House Bill 2007, the Oregon Family Fairness Act, is a huge step in the right direction and will truly benefit the lives of thousands of gay Oregonians, let's be clear. This is not equality, not even close. Couples who obtain a domestic partnership in Oregon will still be denied the more than 1,200 protections, benefits, and responsibilities afforded to married couples under federal law. couples who obtain a domestic partnership will have no legal relationship to one another outside the borders of this state, as married couples do. And of course, they will not have what is truly equal, access to the full equality of marriage itself. So, Mr. Speaker and colleagues, I say to you this. I believe years from now, we will remember the historic significance of this moment. But we will also see plainly the short-sightedness of our efforts. And frankly, it pains me to vote for this bill. But I will, because it's a big step forward on the road to equality. And I say to you, colleagues, to me, it is sad that we are setting up a system of inequality in the name of furthering equality. But nonetheless, I will vote for this bill because it's an advance on the road to equality. And I urge your I vote too. But I also pledge to my constituents and to all Oregonians that I will continue to advocate for full equality under the law. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion, Representative Girard.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, as you know, I will be brief. There's roughly 5,000 years of written history, if you go back to the Chinese, and they tell me to vote no. There's five major religions throughout the globe, and they tell me to vote no. My pastors of my district overwhelmingly tell me to vote no. The individuals in my district voted 70% against gay marriage and tell me to vote no. I'll be voting no, and I'm proud of it.
Further discussion, Representative Clem.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I rise today in support of House Bill 2007. For me, equality under the law is a basic constitutional and fairness issue, and I could spend my time here today speaking from my heart about why I think we ought to support this bill. But I believe the real reason we ought to cast an aye vote today is because of the very real effect that this bill will have on Oregon families. And with that in mind, I want to read to you the story of my constituents, the France Geddes family, as it was presented in testimony to the Rules Committee. My name is Nancy France Geddes, and I write to you on behalf of my partner of 23 years, Peggy France Geddes, and our two beautiful boys, Carter, almost 12, and Cooper, age 9. By speaking about our family's traumatic personal story, I hope to help you understand the importance of legal recognition for families like mine. On Memorial Day of 2000, our oldest son, Carter, hit his head on the edge of a coffee table in our living room. As a nurse, I determined that he indeed would need stitches to close the wound. Peggy, Carter, and I set out for the crowded holiday weekend emergency department. When we arrived at the Salem Hospital, I noticed a male co-worker and his wife, who were coincidentally there with their 5-year-old, who also had a forehead laceration. After a lengthy wait, the co-worker's child was called back for his stitches. The co-worker and his wife both accompanied their child, no questions asked. When Carter's name was called to be seen, the nurse asked us, "Who is the mother here?" We calmly explained that Peggy was the biological mom and I was the adopted mom, to which the nurse replied, "I'm sorry, but only one of you can go with him." Carter looked up at us in fear as we attempted to further explain to the nurse, but again she insisted only one of us go. Only one mom allowed. Not wanting to further delay the treatment for our son, I tearfully acquiesced and sat down in the lobby while Peggy attended to Carter. This experience was traumatic for all of us and completely unnecessary. I never again want to be denied the right to be with my children, especially in the time of need. Our children have two dedicated parents, and making them choose is simply unacceptable. My family is a loving, devoted, cohesive family, and that is equally deserving of the similar protections, rights, and responsibilities afforded other Oregon families without question. My children are invaluable. My children are Oregon's bright future. Please value and protect my family's future from unnecessary discrimination by fully supporting House Bill 2007. From my family to yours, we thank you. This is just one of many stories told and untold out there of the painful discrimination and fear that thousands of Oregon families face each day. By passing this domestic partnership law, we can alleviate the fears of parents and children. We can provide families in Oregon with a strong social safety net to protect them in times of medical, economic, or family crisis. For our fellow citizens, for their children, and for a fair future in our state, I will support this bill. Thank you.
Representative Gelser.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Thank you, colleagues. I rise today in support of House Bill 2007, and I wanted to talk to you a little bit about why this is an issue that's very important to me. Many people might say that I'm an unlikely candidate to be one that looks at this as one of the most important votes that I'll make this session. I'm a married mother of four. I've been married for nearly 14 years, a Christian. I've served as a youth pastor, and yet this is an issue that is important to me and important to my family. It's something that's been important to me since I understood that the harassment and the difficulties that were faced by individuals in my life who were gay or who were lesbian, but became very clear to me about 5 years ago. It was my daughter's first birthday. We had a lovely party, and her godmother left our home. And about a half hour later, I was sitting on the couch nursing my baby, and the phone rang, and it was her godmother's partner, letting me know that she had been hit by a drunk driver. She was in very bad shape. They didn't know what was going to happen. Could I please come right to the emergency room? I was not the first call that my friend's partner made. The first telephone call that she needed to make was to their family's attorney, who they also needed to have meet them at the hospital with the legal papers that gave her the right to make necessary medical decisions for her partner of over a dozen years. When we got to the hospital, it was very scary. She was beaten up pretty badly. The hours went on. She was on a lot of medication and a lot of pain. The doctor came back. Her partner and I were in the room with her, and the doctor said, everybody has to leave except for family. And so we left. When we were brought back, we were told that it was time to take my friend home. This was pretty surprising to us that she could barely move. She was in a lot of pain. She was on a lot of medication. She had just come out of an MRI scan. We took her out to the car. It took two of us to get her into the car. She winced with pain as we put her in. We took her home and undressed her to get her ready for bed and found that up and down her arms were still filled with glass. There was glass on her face and everywhere. And I couldn't help but think on that night that if I had been my friend and was laying in that hospital room, my husband would have been in that room to say, she can't go home. We need to keep her here. On a night when the hospital was full, they had a shortage of beds. And I asked her partner later, why didn't you say, I'm her family. I need to be here. I have a right and an obligation to advocate for her. And she said she didn't know what would happen. On a night that was already too frightening, it wasn't the time to press the envelope and imagine what response might come back. It was interesting that night because it had been exactly 1 year earlier. I mentioned it was my daughter's birthday, and I had given birth to her in a pretty bad childbirth that had a pretty scary outcome. My husband remembers them pushing me down the hallway the next morning to a surgical suite asking, is she going to be okay? And the doctor's answer was, we'll do the very best we can. He didn't call an attorney. He called my mother. He called his mother, who came and sat with him. He didn't have to worry who would have custody of the child that I had just given birth to if their best effort in that surgical room was that I didn't come out. He didn't have to worry about whether or not he would get to make the decisions about what care that I needed next, or whether or not my finances and my holdings would be available to him to support our four children that he had absolute confidence that he would have custody over. These are the protections that people who are in committed, loving, gay and lesbian relationships cannot count on every day, and this is why I support this bill. Last weekend, it became even more clear to me how historic and important and personal this vote is. My daughter had a birthday party, and one of the children came bounding through the door. Her two moms came behind her. One of them, without saying a word, came to me, wrapped her arms around me in an embrace, and began to cry and said, thank you for what it is that you're doing in Salem for my family. And then she said, but I have to tell you, it's really frustrating that I had to think last Monday night about whether or not I wanted to go to the Capitol to explain why this was important, because I have a family. We had T-ball practice and we had soccer practice, and there was homework to do and dinner to cook, and I couldn't disrupt my family to go up and ask for the rights that everyone else has. And that's when it occurred to me, what we are doing here today is not legislating families or creating families. We don't have the power or the authority to do that. Families exist. Soccer games happen. Taxes get paid. People get sick. I know for me, there is no law or lack of law that could disrupt my love or my commitment to my husband, and I'm grateful for that. And I imagine that that's true for our gay and lesbian.
Representative Gelser, hold on just a moment. Representative Riley yields.
Thank you, Representative Riley. I imagine that the same is true for all of those around us. So these families will continue regardless of this law. Our families operate based on a power that's greater than any of us can imagine. The place that we need the law to protect us is in those events where we call an attorney, when someone dies, when cancer strikes, when the drunk driver hits our car, when our child falls off the monkey bars and has a broken arm. What we are doing today is protecting the ability for families that exist and that continue to exist to be able to have the people that love and care for them next to them at the times that it matters the very most. I want my husband to be there with me, and I want to be there for him. I want my friend to have the advocacy and the support that she needs when she's sick and when she's ill and in her very last days. And I want all of you to have that too. Our invocation today ended with be courage and be hope. With our vote today, an I vote allows us to offer hope to these families that they will have this protection when they need it most. So for me today, when I cast my I vote, it's a vote for Jerry and Barb. It's a vote for Ellie and Diana and Sam and Clinton and thousands of individuals across the state of Oregon. It's a vote for hope, and I hope that you will join me in voting yes. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Butler.
Question to the carrier.
Question to the carrier. Does Carrie yield?
I will.
She does.
When you were preparing, Representative, the Oregon Family Fairness Act, was there any attempt or discussion to consider ways in which Oregon domestic partners could enjoy the benefits of filing joint tax returns in the state of Oregon?
Representative, if you're talking about state tax returns, then yes, they would be able to file joint tax returns. Obviously, we cannot affect federal law, and so their filing status under federal law would not be affected.
So clarification, if I may.
Clarification. Does Carrie yield? She does.
I do.
So under the Oregon Family Fairness Act, domestic partners would be able to file a joint Oregon individual income tax return?
Yes.
Follow-up question?
Additional question? Does Carrie yield?
I do.
She does.
Has there been any discussion about the fiscal impact of that action in relationship to this bill?
Representative, are you talking about the fiscal or the revenue impact of the bill?
Clarification.
Please, go ahead.
Representative, I'm concerned that there would be both a fiscal and a revenue. We've got the actual filing of the tax returns and the joining of Social Security account numbers over at the Department of Revenue. Then we have the actual revenue impact, the potential of what happens with regard to domestic partner having a capital loss carry forward and another domestic partner having a large capital gain, so that the combination of those would cancel out on a joint Oregon return.
I'll attempt to address what I think you're asking, because the revenue impact, as is reflected in
a statement that accompanies the bill says that the bill could have a slightly positive or slightly negative revenue impact depending on the circumstances of the affected taxpayers, which I think is what you're referring to. And then if you're talking about the fiscal impact of this bill is essentially indeterminate because, as the analysis says, there's no way of predicting how many potential people would avail themselves of the protections that the bill affords.
Follow-up question.
Follow-up question. Does Carrie yield?
I will.
She does.
The bill provides that there would be an established eligibility, a procedure, and a filing fee of $20 completing a filing of declaration of domestic partnership with the county clerk, which affords the various rights that we've been talking about. What happens to my constituents in House District 60 or any of the other 59 districts who happen to be on vacation in Idaho or Utah or Texas or other places? Do all of those rights that they have availed themselves to under the Oregon County Clerk filing for $25, do they follow them so that they have those same rights in other states?
Thank you, Representative, for that question. The protections of a domestic partnership under House Bill 2007 would only apply in the state of Oregon. They do not apply in other states. And that, in fact, is one of the differences between domestic partnership and contractual marriage.
Thank you very much. To the bill.
To the bill.
And just briefly, I don't want to belabor this anymore, but I just want to read a statement which was issued 20 years ago this month by a great American jurist and a man who I have great revere for, a man by the name of James E. Faust. He said, "Private choices are not private. They all have public consequences. Our society is the sum total of what millions of individuals do in their private lives. The sum total of the private behavior has worldwide public consequences of enormous magnitude. There are no completely private choices." And finally, from John Adams, the second president of the United States, "Our Constitution was made only for a moral and religious people. It is wholly inadequate to the government of any other."
Further discussion? Seeing none, Representative Kotek, do you wish to close?
Yes, Mr. Speaker, I do. Thank you.
Colleagues, as you can imagine, this debate is like no other that I will face in my life here as a state representative. The discussion here and the outcome today will have a tremendous impact on my life and on the life of my loved ones. But this moment is so much bigger than me, bigger than my family, and bigger than this legislative assembly. This bill is about caring for all Oregon families. Our goal today, as it is every day, is to ensure that Oregon's parents are more secure, Oregon's children are better protected, and all Oregon families, regardless of whether they are headed by a straight or gay couple, have the opportunity to thrive. The world will be different, more fair, more just, more equal, because we take action today. Now, I'm not naive. I know if this law, if passed, will not stop bigotry or prejudice. I know that you can't legislate what people hold in their heart. But we should not and cannot let some Oregonians' discomfort with other people's families stop us from creating good public policy that promotes family stability, especially when it is so desperately needed. And while this vote is not just about me and my family, this vote is about me and my family. And this vote is about the families who have asked, begged, pleaded, and even demanded the protections, rights, and responsibilities that domestic partnerships provide. They're holding their breath, colleagues, waiting for us to do what's right. Let us not disappoint them. Fundamentally, this is a vote about our values, about the character of our state, about the inherent importance of all of our citizens. This is a vote about bringing people in, not shutting them out. This is a vote about who we are now and who we want to be. Again, I urge your aye vote. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Before we take the vote, I'd like to remind the public that any expressions of support or dissent are inappropriate in the House chambers, and please carry those expressions outside. Those who are of the opinion the bill should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. Representative Lim, how do you vote? Votes no. House Bill 2007A, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Clerk, will read the next bill.
Senate Bill 2, relating to sexual orientation discrimination.
The question now arises on third reading and final passage of Senate Bill 2A. Representative Rosenbaum.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, it is my great honor to bring you Senate Bill 2A, which comes to you from the House Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules. It is the basic nature of our system of politics and government that complex concepts often are reduced to very simple propositions. And in the case of Senate Bill 2, it seems that the opposite is occurring. In a moment, I'll try to provide a brief overview of the provisions of this 21-page bill. Colleagues, I doubt that you'll be surprised to find a great deal of detail and nuance there. But this complex piece of legislation is born of one of the most profoundly simple and straightforward notions that we have ever encountered. If you are an American, you have the same rights and responsibilities as every other American. Senate Bill 2 came from the Elections Committee, but it is also brought to you by people who share the belief that we as elected officials are bound by honor and duty to reflect that principle in the way we do our jobs. In broad terms, Senate Bill 2 establishes that a person cannot be refused employment, fired from a job, denied rental housing, or denied service in a restaurant because of his or her sexual orientation. These protections extend to every sexual orientation, which of course includes heterosexuals. Here are some of the specific anti-discrimination statutes that are amended by Senate Bill 2A. Employment. Senate Bill 2 would make it illegal for an employer, labor union, or employment agency to refuse to hire or discharge an individual or to discriminate against an individual in the compensation, terms, or conditions of employment on the basis of sexual orientation. The bill explicitly allows employers to enforce valid dress codes and policies with reasonable accommodations to the health and safety of employees. In the area of housing, Senate Bill 2 would outlaw discrimination based on sexual orientation in housing, specifically in the following areas: sale, lease, or rental of real property, expulsion of a purchaser from rental property, restrictions or distinctions in the terms, conditions, or privileges relating to the sale, rental, lease, or occupancy of real property. In public accommodation, the bill would prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation in public accommodations like stores, hotels, and restaurants. In public services, Senate Bill 2 would prohibit the state from discriminating against an individual based on sexual orientation when the individual is being considered for admission to state programs and services.
For example, the state could not decide that someone is unable to live in the state mental hospital because of that person's sexual orientation. In education, Senate Bill 2 prohibits the state from discriminating against students based on sexual orientation when considering their admission to public schools and universities. The bill also prohibits a public charter school from refusing to admit a student because of sexual orientation. In policy terms, the bulk of Senate Bill 2 is really a series of amendments to existing statutes. But as we can attest, this is far from being a simple bill. Of all the questions before this body, there may well be none more controversial than that of whether we should extend basic rights and protections to all Oregonians. It is to the credit of this institution that today we come together on behalf of our respective communities to address this very emotional issue in the earnest spirit of deliberation and respect. But this issue is contentious for a reason. Sometimes different values, different valid, equal, legitimate values, come into conflict. We can't get around that. We may not always like it, but as legislators, it is our job to mediate that conflict. And on some level, that means compromise. And toward that end, a broad religious exemption was included in Senate Bill 2A. Many people feel that all discrimination is 100% wrong and should not be tolerated. On the other hand, many people feel that any restriction on the prerogatives of a religious institution is inappropriate. In attempting to balance those concerns, we turn to the language behind another religious exemption in existing law, the exemption that allows churches and other religious organizations to discriminate based on religion. There are already strong protections of religious freedom enshrined in the federal and state constitution, but the language of the religious exemption included in Senate Bill 2 goes even further. During the committee process in the House, this exemption was amended once again to add even more language, assuring Oregon churches that their right to exercise their religion will not be hampered by Senate Bill 2. The end result is a religious exemption that not only is broader and stronger than that included in Senate Bill 1000 from the 2005 session, but that is in fact the broadest religious exemption of any sort set in Oregon law. Colleagues, I'm proud to have presided over the hearings on Senate Bill 2. We had a very open and deliberative committee process. We spent over 4 hours, in fact, 4.5 hours, listening to public testimony, as well as hours of invited testimony. We invited advocates on both sides to present their positions to the committee, and we heard from people who had lost their jobs, lost their housing, and lost their families as a result of the kind of discrimination which we today stand at the precipice of forbidding. My colleague from Lake Oswego will go into more depth on the legal meaning of this bill. For now, I want to close by returning to a point I made earlier, that after we unpack the extensive legal and political baggage accompanying this debate, we really are left with just three simple questions. Are all Oregonians free from discrimination? Do all Oregonians deserve to be free from discrimination? And finally, do we have the courage to continue to deny that freedom, or do we have the courage to correct that injustice? Colleagues, I am proud to join with Oregon political and business leaders, members of the faith community, and thousands of deserving Oregon families in asking for your aye vote on Senate Bill 2A.
Co-Kerry, Representative McPherson.
Speaker. Colleagues, Oregon law now protects its citizens from discrimination in employment, housing, public accommodation, and a variety of other matters regulated by our statutes. This protection applies to distinctions based on race, religion, color, sex, national origin, marital status, and age. Senate Bill 2 adds to this list sexual orientation. At its heart, Senate Bill 2 is about equality. In the workplace, people ought to be judged on the basis of their talents and their ability to contribute, not by what they do in the privacy of their bedrooms. In housing and public accommodation, people should be accepted and served based on their ability to pay,
and not on who they form their intimate personal connections to. There are places in Oregon where this is already the case under local ordinances. Two counties and seven cities have extended protection from discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. These include Lake Oswego, where I live, and Salem, where we are gathered today. And from my observation, the social order in Lake Oswego and in Salem has not suffered as a result of providing this protection. But outside these islands of protection, Oregonians are at risk of discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. Your Committee on Elections, Ethics, and Rules heard many stories of discrimination, both blatant and subtle. Colleagues, it's not right that most Oregonians lack the protections given locally to others. Should one worker, by virtue of his employer's address, have access to a legal remedy against discrimination when another, who works in a different city, does not? Should an Oregonian who is accustomed to being open about her sexual orientation be forced to hide it when she tries to rent an apartment in another county? Equality should not end at the city boundary or the county line. And it's important for our laws to be consistent. People ought to know where they stand, and our judges should not have to parse the complexities of different local ordinances. But more importantly, from an ethical standpoint, discrimination that is intolerable in one place is just as intolerable in another. This bill does not grant special rights or privileges. It does not, as claimed by some, require affirmative action, those preferences in educational admissions or hiring that are aimed to make up for past discrimination. It simply extends to Oregonians the protections the law already gives them from discrimination on the basis of race, religion, and national origin. Some may ask, why do Oregonians need this protection? The answer to this question can be found in the letters and emails all of us have been receiving in recent days. Unfortunately, there are many who are offended by the fact that others have a different sexual orientation. While disparagement on the basis of race or religion is now viewed as unacceptable, that sadly is not the case with respect to this prejudice. It's time for our discrimination statutes to be extended to this further distinction so that it will, over time, cease to divide Oregonians. I urge an aye vote on Senate Bill 2 because it's the right thing to do.
Further discussion, Representative Kotek.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
To the bill.
To the bill. Colleagues, I rise today in support of Senate Bill 2. As your friend and as a fellow Oregonian for whom this bill has a very personal importance. For more than three decades, this legislature, our legislature, has been asked by those we represent to end discrimination based on sexual orientation in employment, housing, public accommodation, and other areas. Not to grant, as some would call them, special rights, but to allow gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender Oregonians to have simple equality. To offer people like me basic fairness. Most Oregonians are shocked to learn that in this day and age, this kind of discrimination still exists. Most Oregonians think it's unjust that Oregon's laws don't prevent someone from being turned away from a table in a restaurant, fired from a job, or denied housing because of a person's sexual orientation. Oregonians of all stripes believe that discrimination does not fit with Oregon values, and they think it ought to be against the law. I've personally felt the sting of discrimination many times. For example, I was once told to take my money elsewhere when I wanted to open a joint bank account with a partner. Fortunately, whether by fate or good luck, I've not been fired, I've not been denied housing, or public accommodation. But that's not because the law protected me or protects me now. As you know, our state today is a patchwork of local ordinances, where I may be protected in one zip code, but not the next one over. Our state laws should protect all of us from these kinds of discrimination, no matter where we live, work, or travel throughout the state of Oregon. I first came out to my parents in 1990 when I graduated from the University of Oregon. And yes, I'm coming out as a duck today. I apologize, it is OSU Day. So I was home visiting, family visit, and my family in Pennsylvania.
And I was in love and wanted to share it with my family, so I came out to my family. And they were pretty good about it. But it wasn't easy at first, especially for my mother, because my mother was worried, that people would treat me differently, discriminate against me, provide me less opportunity because of who I am, because of my sexual orientation. I don't want any mother or father here in Oregon to worry about their children the way my mother worried about me. But unfortunately, as we heard in public testimony last week, many parents do worry because we have so far failed to protect their children. The committee heard from Jim Donnelly from Parkdale in the Upper Hood River Valley, a father of three children, the youngest of whom is a lesbian. He worries about his daughter. He said, quote, "Our two older children and spouses have all the rights and responsibilities every person should have. Their rights to housing, employment, and public accommodation is a given without question. Our youngest daughter and her partner do not have these same rights because of their sexual orientation, even though they are the same good citizens that my other two children are. Just as a person is born left-handed or brown-eyed, our youngest daughter was born as a lesbian. It is who she is. And as a citizen of our state, she deserves the rights and responsibilities that all the rest of us take for granted," unquote. Colleagues, why should Mr. Donnelly worry about his daughter? The committee also heard from Brian and Linda Stahl from the Dalles, the parents of two sons, of whom their oldest is gay. They spoke eloquently and proudly about their gay son, his accomplishments, and his good qualities. They closed by saying, quote, "It is so easy to dehumanize people by talking about behaviors. Our son cannot be reduced to a behavior, nor can any of the other gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgendered people of Oregon. We are talking about family members, coworkers, neighbors, members of our faith communities, not behaviors," unquote. Colleagues, why should the Stahls have to defend the very humanity of their son? Brian Roeder from Portland told the committee about his daughter Casey and her partner Catherine, who had scrimped and saved their dollars so they could have a special weekend to celebrate their anniversary. They surfed the net to find the perfect Oregon getaway and made their reservations. When the big day arrived, they headed off to enjoy themselves. Of course, the rest of the family looked forward to hearing about this wonderful place Casey and Catherine were going to visit. Unfortunately, the report back from the girls was very disturbing. When they arrived at their destination, after driving 6 hours to get there and announced that they were celebrating the third anniversary, the desk clerk suddenly determined there was no room at the inn.
Representative Gelser yields.
Thank you, Representative. It didn't matter that they had made their reservations weeks in advance, that they had the confirmation number, that they had showed up on the agreed-upon time. The message couldn't have been clearer. Lesbians were not welcome. Mr. Roeder told the committee, quote, "Of course, like any father would have been, I was furious. Like any father, I only want what's best for my children and for them to be safe and happy. Like any father, I want to be sure that my children's opportunities in the workplace are determined by their skills and work ethic and not limited by their sexual orientation. Like any father, I've looked forward to the day that each of my children will rent or purchase their first home with their options determined by their budget and taste and not limited by their sexual orientation. Like any father, I eagerly anticipate hearing stories of dinners out, resorts and campgrounds visited, and new adventures experienced, without dreading that my children's sexual orientation will somehow spoil those times." Colleagues, surely we do not want other Oregon fathers like Mr. Roeder to worry about their daughters. This year, 17 years after I came out to my mother, and 34 years since the Oregon legislature first took up this topic, I would like to be able to say that we have finally put an end to discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation into Oregon law. It is time, colleagues. Our great state should be a place where simple equality for all is the law of the land. Any opening, any possibility, any allowance for discrimination is not right for our great state. It's not right for my constituents, the good people of North and Northeast Portland, nor is it right or fair or just for the good people in your home districts who every day worry about losing their jobs, their livelihoods, or their housing because of who they are. It's time we take action to make discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation illegal in all of Oregon. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion, Representative Maurer.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question to the carrier.
Question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield? He does.
Thank you. My colleague from Lake Wasego, this is a very simple question. In Section 3, Paragraph 4, which is on page 3 of Senate Bill 2 Alpha, the phrase "including but not limited to" is used to identify bona fide church or other religious institutions. But in the next paragraph, 5, of the same section, the committee apparently chose not to use the same language and instead just lists some types of employment positions. I'm wondering why the committee chose to limit the possible types of employment positions instead of using the language "including but not limited to."
The language "including but not limited to" actually was in the existing statute. If you look on page 2, it was moved from subsection 2 and then made a separate subsection under 4. It's an existing provision of the non-discrimination statute which applies to the hiring of individuals in churches and other religious institutions. That has been a feature of our statutes for a long time, that is, it permitting a church or other religious institution to favor its own members. The exemption which was added by the committee is the religious exemption that's in Section 5 on page 3, starting lines 12 down to line 23, and that is a more broadly stated exemption that was specifically crafted to meet the concerns expressed in public testimony over this bill. And so we have language that was specifically responsive to the concern and has a several-tier exemption that I think broadly covers the issues surrounding churches and other religious institutions.
For the discussion, Representative Bonamici.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question to the carrier from Lake Oswego, please.
Question of the carrier. Does carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. Some people claim that enactment of Senate Bill 2 would cause an employer who terminates or fails to hire a gay or lesbian person to be subject to the expense of a lawsuit charging discrimination in spite of the fact that he or she had absolutely no awareness of the employee or applicant's sexual orientation. So how can we hold people responsible for discrimination if it's not apparent that they're covered by the law?
Representative, there's no more risk of unfounded lawsuits under this bill than there is under the existing non-discrimination statute of the state. We already have categories that are protected that are not readily apparent by outward observation. For example, national origin and religious beliefs are both protected under our existing statute, and employers have not, to my knowledge, had difficulty defending themselves from those claims. And that is because the burden falls squarely on the claimant to prove that there was discrimination that was on the basis of those characteristics. In this case, it would be sexual orientation. And if the employer doesn't know about the sexual orientation of the employee, of course, there's no way that that proof could be made.
Thank you. Further question of the carrier?
Additional question of the carrier. Does carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you. Representative McPherson, I've heard some confusion about whether Senate Bill 2 adds sexual orientation to the affirmative action laws existing in Oregon. Can you please clarify this?
There should be no confusion on this point. Senate Bill 2 amends the non-discrimination statute of the state, the basic one that's in ORS Chapter 659A, and then a number of other provisions dealing with discrimination. There are provisions in our statutes that provide for affirmative action, and those are not amended by this bill. So there would be no obligation under this bill to provide affirmative action in favor of people based on sexual orientation.
Thank you. To the bill?
To the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I rise today in support of Senate Bill 2. This morning we recited a pledge that we do each morning, reminding us that America is a nation that values liberty and justice for all. Not justice for some, justice for all. Senate Bill 2, the Oregon Equality Act, prohibits discrimination based on sexual orientation. And to do this, it adds sexual orientation to the existing anti-discrimination statute. And as you have heard, it includes a strong religious exemption. When it comes to employment, a person's ability and qualifications to do the job, not his or her sexual orientation, should be what matters. As Theodore Roosevelt said, far and away the best prize that life has to offer is the chance to work hard at work worth doing. For our future and our economy, we should not allow discrimination to hinder Oregonians from reaching their full potential. At least 17 other states have enacted anti-discrimination legislation. 10 Oregon cities and 2 Oregon counties already prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation. By passing Senate Bill 2, we will make this prohibition statewide policy and avoid a patchwork of inconsistent requirements. As Michael Hollerin, a leading businessman from Bend, wrote, quote, the 12 local ordinances in Oregon have yielded positive results. However, the presence of these many local ordinances has resulted in a legal patchwork which can be extremely challenging for business people like me. Our business operates in Bend, where a local ordinance banning discrimination exists, as well as in Prineville and Madras, where there is no ordinance. I can tell you from firsthand experience that one consistent statewide law would be a far better solution for business owners. I agree with Mr. Hollerin. And Senate Bill 2 is as good for Oregon businesses as it is for Oregon employees. A rich and diverse talent pool is critical to building a successful business. With Senate Bill 2, Oregon joins the ranks of other business-friendly states, making it that much easier to attract and keep top talent. During the committee hearing on this bill, Oregon's only Fortune 500 company, Nike, which happens to be in my district, said that diversity drives innovation. They found that diversity is a competitive advantage and that a fair and equitable work environment adds to their success in the global marketplace. Sure, Nike is the type of business that can afford to set its own standards of inclusiveness, even when the law might not require it. But to get that top talent they so desperately need to compete, they need to offer more than just benefits packages and high salaries. That's where we come in. With our help, Nike and all other Oregon businesses that compete in the global marketplace will gain a competitive advantage in attracting the best talent because we have set standards for the entire state. But it isn't just the large businesses who benefit. You have in your bill file a letter from 11 of Oregon's leading large and small businesses who said, in the workplace, diversity and inclusion of all Oregonians makes us stronger, healthier businesses. And another letter from more than 75 small businesses who agree that it is important to end discrimination based on sexual orientation. Mike Hollerin wrote in his letter that passing Senate Bill 2 can help to ensure an environment that will continue to help retain and attract the brightest and most creative young people to Oregon and Oregon's workforce. I couldn't agree more. But colleagues, we don't need testimony from business leaders to tell us what we already know. Businesses that choose employees on the basis of their skills will always have a competitive advantage over businesses that unnecessarily disqualify good applicants. Businesses located in places where there is a level playing field for both employers and employees have a lot more to offer new employees. Colleagues, discrimination isn't just. It isn't right, and it isn't a good business practice, because it allows businesses to make decisions on the basis of prejudice. That's true in Oregon and across this great country. We all know the patriotic song, America, America, God shed his grace on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea. America the Beautiful was written by Professor Catherine Bates, a songwriter, poet, and professor of English literature. If Professor Bates were alive today and living in Oregon, she would not be protected from discrimination based on her sexual orientation. I, for one, find that profoundly unjust. Please join me in voting yes on Senate Bill 2.
Further discussion, Representative Cannon.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier. Does Kerry yield?
I do.
Thank you. There seems to be a certain amount of confusion about Sections 2 and 29 of Senate Bill 2. Could you clarify, does the bill require Oregon's public schools to teach homosexuality?
Thank you, Representative, for that question. And let me be quite clear. Section 2 in no way establishes
educational requirements for Oregon's public schools or adds to the curriculum to be taught in schools. In fact, the only reference to public education in Senate Bill 2 is, as you point out, in Section 2, which amends the statutes outlining the responsibilities of the Bureau of Labor and Industries when enforcing non-discrimination law. This longstanding statute seeks to ensure the human dignity of all peoples within this state and protect them from intercrop hostility, tensions, and practices of discrimination. The current language goes on to say that to accomplish this purpose, the Legislative Assembly intends by this chapter to provide a program of public education calculated to eliminate attitudes upon which practices of discrimination are based. However, the only program of public education this statute will affect is the Bureau of Labor and Industries Technical Assistance for Employers program. This technical assistance program provides assistance to employers through advice by telephone, written materials, and seminars to help them understand their responsibilities under state and federal law. This statute in no way governs public schools. This statute has absolutely nothing to do with curriculum. In Section 29, Senate Bill 2 does add to the Department of Education statute barring discrimination in public schools in program services or interschool activities and defining discrimination as any act that unreasonably differentiates treatment. This statute has nothing to do with curriculum or textbooks. The statute's currently governing the ability for public schools in Oregon to make curriculum decisions at the local level is not amended by Senate Bill 2. I hope that answers your question.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
I think that response from the good representative in Southeast and Northeast Portland makes it clear that Senate Bill 2 will have no bearing on what is being taught in schools. I do want to speak for a minute about the effect that I believe Senate Bill 2 will have in schools. Officially, as we heard, Section 29 prohibits discrimination against a student on the basis of his or her sexual orientation. And if this passes, a school will, to my reading, and if I understood the carrier correctly, a school will violate the law if it denies access to a class, a program, or a sport to a student for the sole reason that that student is gay. Teachers will be prohibited from discriminatory treatment on the basis of sexual orientation. But I believe the passage of Senate Bill 2 will have a more profound effect in schools than merely prohibiting these official acts of discrimination. In fact, Senate Bill 2 will help make schools more tolerant, more accepting, and safer environments for all students. This bill cannot, in and of itself, change the way that kids act toward each other. Words like gay and queer and worse thrown as insults across a crowded hallway or whispered behind a classmate's back will continue to sting. But Senate Bill 2 does send a powerful message to principals, to teachers, and to students that Oregon does not tolerate discrimination in our schools. By passing this bill, we stand symbolically with the principal who wants to address this type of bullying but is concerned about the community's reaction. We stand symbolically with the teachers who adopt a zero-tolerance policy toward hateful speech in the classroom. And we stand with the courageous student who calls out a peer for the insult thrown across the hallway. Senate Bill 2 will help make our schools safer, more tolerant, and more understanding. Colleagues, I wanted to also say just a few general words about this bill. We've heard a lot about the significant step forward that Senate Bill 2 represents for equality. I share this excitement, but I also wanted to pose the question, equality for what? In what sense is this equality valuable? And posed that way, I think it is possible to see that Senate Bill 2 is about something even deeper than equality. By prohibiting discrimination in employment and housing and public accommodation, Senate Bill 2 speaks directly to our heritage as a society that makes liberty the supreme principle governing human relationships. No one's freedom to seek housing or employment should be diminished on the basis of something as irrelevant as their sexual orientation. The Englishman John Stuart Mill, one of the 19th century founders of the modern concept of liberty seem to understand that it is our ability to make choices that makes us truly human. Others may make choices that we disagree with, even find repugnant, but as long as those choices don't harm others, we should tolerate them. Likewise, as legislators, perhaps our most profound responsibility is to preserve and extend individual liberty insofar as it does not harm others. Discrimination, in any form, undercuts and narrows the possible choices available to those who are victims of it. No Oregonian should see their freedom to compete for jobs and in the marketplace diminished because of their sexual orientation. Please join me in voting yes on Senate Bill 2.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I rise today in support of Senate Bill 2A. I have for several weeks now, leading up to today's debate, witnessed both the subtle and not so subtle intolerance of some because of this bill and my support of it. It is incomprehensible to me that in the year 2007, in this great state, that we should be or having to debate civil rights and equal protections for all Oregonians. In similar fashion, it is painful to find myself in the wake of a decades-old time warp where insults cheapen the humanity of others and makes the intolerance of others seem easier, if not appropriate. Much of the intolerance that I have witnessed over the past several weeks surrounding Senate Bill 2 takes on the air of a moral imperative, with references made to the need to protect society, religion, our Constitution, our educational system, and even our children. The opponent's zeal rising at times to near alarming levels. Ultimately, I have been told that gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people have no one to blame but themselves, that they are under no genetic imperative regarding their sexual preference, so they make the conscientious decisions that result in discrimination. In essence, the victims bear the responsibility for whatever levels of intolerance or discriminatory practices they are exposed to. It is intolerance that makes Senate Bill 2A so important, because it is intolerance that leads to good employees being fired and good tenants being evicted and good citizens being denied service. Colleagues, we must put an end to this kind of discriminatory practices, and that is why I am urging your aye vote today on Senate Bill 2A. Finally, I would like to comment on the determinants of sexual preference. Such preference is no more of a choice than is my right-handedness or my blood brother's left-handedness. As I have already stated, I have witnessed several weeks of intolerance surrounding Senate Bill 2. It has not been an experience I would choose to visit upon myself, and as a result, I would strongly suggest that rational human beings do not choose lifetimes of intolerance and discrimination, the likes of which I have only tasted. Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and colleagues, once again, I urge your support of Senate Bill 2A and the end of discrimination. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Shields.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, like the last bill, I will be supporting Senate Bill 2, but not happily. As someone who has attended Catholic schools where there are hundreds of jobs in Oregon as someone who's worked for the Salvation Army, a church where there are hundreds of jobs in Oregon, as someone who's interned with Volunteers of America, a church where there are hundreds of jobs in Oregon, and as a proud member of Ainsworth United Church of Christ, I say to you that it saddens me that we will pass legislation today that says it's okay to fire someone simply because of their sexual orientation if they work for a church. According to Nonprofit World magazine, about 10% of America's economy is in the nonprofit sector, and a large part of that 10% is in churches. Why on earth will we allow so many employers to fire good workers just because they're gay? My colleague from Ashland argued for a more reasonable religious exemption during the committee work session, and I am disappointed that the committee chose to allow for discrimination by churches, even in housing and facilities. And while I appreciate the great lengths our leadership has gone to compromise, I feel I must put on the record my discomfort with the amendments to this bill. But I say to you, colleagues and Mr. Speaker, nonetheless, this bill is an advance on the road to equality. I will be voting yes, and I urge your aye vote on Senate Bill 2. Thank you, Mr. Speaker.
Further discussion, Representative Hunt.
Question of the carrier from Lake Oswego.
Question of the carrier from Lake Oswego. Do you yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. Senate Bill 2 uses the terms bona fide church and a religious institution, as well as bona fide religious belief about sexual orientation. Will these terms permit the government to determine that certain religious beliefs are prohibited?
No. For many years, our laws have drawn a distinction between the treatment of religious institutions and those that are not, and so it's been, for various purposes, including tax laws, employment laws, and other types of laws as well. And what our courts and administrative bodies have had to do is to determine whether an institution is religious, but that does not extend to a determination about the about whether the content of the religious observance itself, so that in fact there'll be no inquiry beyond that which is already undertaken by our laws, which is whether that institution is a religious institution.
Further question of the carrier from Lake Oswego.
Further question of the carrier, do you yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you. Can you clarify the language in the bill regarding religious exemption? Is it true that Senate Bill 2 would codify the ability of a judge to decide what is and is not the primary purpose of a church or religious institution?
Section 3 of Senate Bill 2 amends ORS Chapter 659A.006, which has been in Oregon law for many years. It governs the rights and responsibilities of religious employers. Leading constitutional scholars made several good points in the presentation to the Committee on Rules. Section 3 has been very broadly written to protect religious institutions. It goes further than what's required by the federal and state constitutions. The standards that are set by Senate Bill 2 would apply to religious institutions that are the same ones that are applied by state and federal courts, providing special benefits or exemptions to churches. And the religious freedoms that are enshrined in our state and federal constitutions will supersede any Oregon statute. We can't change those here on this floor. So those protections already guard our religious institutions, so they will not be subject to further burdens.
Thank you. To the bill.
To the bill.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, the meaning of our constitutional and founding principles were never meant to be frozen in stone or frozen in time. When our nation was founded, and even when our state was founded, with the idea that all of us are created equal by God, what that really meant in civic political terms was that you had to be white, you had to be male, and you had to own property. Over time, we have redefined, and our forebears in these positions have redefined our understanding of the words that we started with, not because there was anything inherently wrong with those words and their universal power,
but because we were limited and our predecessors were limited in our imaginations about how we could live and what we were capable of achieving. The story of how we have grown to new and even more meaningful definitions of equality, of dignity, of freedom, I think is in the essence of the fundamental story of our state and our country. Indeed, even in Oregon, our failure to imagine the infinite nature of equality and freedom has too often led us to deny fairness or to delay in addressing inequality. That's been true in this body. If you look back at history, each and every time we have been asked to grapple with moral questions of equality. Even when this body, in the past, acted to prohibit discrimination based on religion, based on gender, based on marital status, based on age, even when they were making amendments to the very statute we consider today, there was division. Every time that we have expanded our anti-discrimination statute, there has been opposition. Frankly, some have thought it went too far at times back in our history. Others have thought it didn't go far enough. There were dire predictions about how those changes would affect our culture. Now today, with the benefit of 2020 hindsight, we can look back at these civil rights protections, and they seem like common sense. We look back and wonder what the fear and the debate was all about back then. Colleagues, Senate Bill 2A embodies the lessons that we have learned in each of these debates of conscience, that broadening our notions of freedom, of justice, of fairness to another group of Oregonians need not come at the expense of any Oregonians. I believe this bill encompasses two core values that I deeply care about, and I think many of us care about: fairness and equality under the law for all, and the freedom of people of faith to live and worship according to the tenets of our faith, free of government interference. You've already heard many compelling arguments about fairness and equality under the law, regardless of sexual orientation, and I will not repeat those because they've been effectively made. Instead, I would like to be very clear about how this bill, at the same time it extends freedom from discrimination to fellow Oregonians, also preserves the free exercise of religion as well. 2 weeks ago, I had the opportunity to sit down with a group of about 30 pastors who came into my office, all of whom expressed significant concerns with the original language in the bill and its ability and the ability of religious institutions and churches to operate according to religious beliefs about sexual orientation. We've all received letters and phone calls. We've all had these meetings. We've all heard the testimony before the Elections and Rules Committee. In response to those concerns, in the committee we were able to successfully amend Senate Bill 2. We amended the bill specifically to strengthen the free exercise of religion and address the concerns that were raised by those pastors and our constituents across Oregon without harming the anti-discrimination protections in the bill. The key changes we made were removing the sectarian language. Some Oregonians and even some of our legislative colleagues raised concerns about the inclusion of the term sectarian religious institution in the religious exemption. They feared that the term sectarian would leave religious organizations that were not affiliated with a specific church or a specific denomination open to lawsuits. In response to these concerns, the term sectarian has been removed so that the language of the bill more inclusively reads bona fide church or other religious institution. The amendments clarified employment positions in response to the concerns that were raised. We added language that clarifies that any position in a church or other place of worship is exempt, including positions, quote, such as clergy, religious instructors, and support staff, unquote. This change makes it clear that a church or religious institution can use discretion in hiring of employees such as a janitor, secretary, or landscaper if, in the opinion of the church or religious institution, such a preference will benefit the mission.
Representative Cowan yields.
Thank you, Representative. If, in the opinion of the church or religious institution, such a preference will benefit the mission of the church or religious institution. In response to the concerns that were raised, language has been added to Senate Bill 2A that explicitly details what types of religious nonprofit organizations are exempt from the bill. It says, quote, a religious school, religious camp, religious daycare center, religious thrift store, religious bookstore, religious radio station, or religious shelter. Finally, in response to the concerns that were raised, the bill also provides an additional general exemption for those institutions that may not explicitly fit into the categories I just discussed. Quote, for employment positions that involve religious activities, as long as the employment involved is closely connected with or related to the primary purposes of the church and is not connected with a commercial or business activity that has no necessary relationship to that church or institution. So under this provision, employment positions in truly religious activities related to a church or religious institution would be exempt. Examples of the type of institutions that would fit under this category are things like Young Life, things like Luis Palau Ministries. I believe that these changes and the strengthened religious exemption represent a good faith effort to give broad deference to churches and religious institutions across our state. For some, alleviating these concerns will be enough to remove their opposition to the legislation. Others will continue to oppose it. My own Christian faith leads me to a place of inclusion. In searching my own faith and my own individual conscience, I believe that I am called by God to advocate for others, to advocate for the full equality and inclusion of all Oregonians in civic and religious life. And my viewpoint is not unique among people of faith. Over the last 20 years especially, churches have made enormous strides in our attitudes, policies, and practices concerning people who are gay. For instance, the Episcopal Church, Reformed Judaism, United Churches of Christ welcome and affirm participation of gay people in all aspects of spiritual life. Other major denominations, most notably Presbyterians, United Methodists, and Baptists, have hundreds of welcome and affirming congregations. In Oregon, Ecumenical Ministries of Oregon, representing more than a dozen denominations across our state, supports Senate Bill 2 and has raised no concerns about its application to churches or religious institutions. Colleagues, I believe today that some will present this vote as a choice between people of faith and people of differing sexual orientations. I believe that's a false choice. I believe that's also really a failure to imagine, as I said earlier, the infinite nature of God's grace and the infinite nature of freedom and equality. Many of you know I'm a preacher's kid, and my father's memorial service, about 2.5 years ago, we had a wonderful recitation of people who had been, after 40 years of ministry, people he had served as members of his congregation across several states and cities. As people got up and shared about the meaningful ministry he had done with them, one of the most significant to me was someone who I did not know was a lesbian. I knew her as my favorite babysitter when I was growing up. She stood up and affirmed the significance that my dad had played in her life by being there at a time when she was coming to terms with her sexual orientation. And Dad, as the pastor of that congregation, was there for her. She rose to say and affirm his legacy in her life as affirming a connection between the God she loved and wanted to serve and her sexual orientation. That was my father's legacy. Today is our legacy. We have the opportunity to cast a vote based on fairness, based on sexual orientation, and based on religious free exercise. These are not mutually exclusive concepts. The expansion of religion, the expansion of freedom, the expansion of fairness does not threaten any of the others, but in fact strengthens their value and meaning in our culture. I urge your aye vote.
Further discussion, Representative Flores.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question of the carrier from Lake Oswego.
Question of the carrier from Lake Oswego. Do you yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. I would like to re-clarify a couple of questions that were asked. The first, Section 2, which is on page 2, and that section calls for that program of public education calculated to eliminate attitudes about sexual orientation. My question is, if this, it states that this is the intention of the legislature, can you tell me how that will be implemented?
Thank you, Representative. I can't give you any more detail than what is in the bill, and as you may notice,
There is already a provision in our statute, ORS 659 Cap A .003, that calls for a program of public education calculated to eliminate attitudes upon which practices of discrimination because of race, religion, color, sex, marital status, or national origin are based. And this simply adds sexual orientation to that list. So there's nothing in this bill that does anything more with respect to that program of public education or adds any additional detail than what our statutes already have with respect to those other bases for discrimination.
Follow-up.
Follow-up question, do you yield?
I do.
He does.
And thank you. This is just to get clarification of what that program of public education that is currently in existence and addresses, what does that look like? How do we see that coming forth from industry or labor?
What I'm told by my co-carrier is that the Bureau of Labor and Industries has a program of public education, and what would happen is that the matters of sexual orientation would be simply added onto that program. I don't have any more information than that about the nature of that program.
Additional question?
Additional question, do you yield?
I do.
Thank you, Representative. And then to the Section 29 that deals with prohibited discrimination in education. In the definition of, and that is at page
20.
Yes, it is. 20. In the definition of discrimination relating to public education, that section includes the phrase unreasonably differentiate treatment. Can you give us some examples of unreasonable differentiation? And let me clarify a little bit. There was testimony at the hearing from a lobbyist from Oregon Family Council, in which it was mentioned that potentially students with gay parents may feel unreasonably differentiated against because their family's not represented equally in the curriculum. He also mentioned a case out of Massachusetts where a judge told two sets of parents who wanted to be informed when homosexuality-themed material was being taught to their second graders that their rights to educate their children stop at the schoolhouse door. The judge also wrote in his opinion that it is reasonable for educators to find that teaching young children to understand and respect differences in sexual orientation will contribute to an academic environment in which students who are gay, lesbian, or the children of same-sex parents will be comfortable and therefore better able to learn. I think it's without question that we want every child to learn better. But the question is, what is the definition of unreasonable differentiation, and what steps will be necessary as school districts, as they are going to be moving to manage their risk to guard against potential lawsuits, to feel that they are not unreasonably differentiating against gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender students, or the students of gay, lesbian, bisexual, or transgender parents?
Well, first, just to reemphase something that was made as a point earlier, is that this provision does not affect curriculum. So there's nothing about this bill that would affect the content of what would have to be taught. What this section, Section 29 of the bill, ORS 659.850, deals with is access to public education. Now, the phrase that you asked about, unreasonably differentiates, is already in the statute. It's not being added by this provision. And so there would be a body of administrative practice that applies that phrasing to matters of age, disability, national origin, race, marital status, religion, sex, all those other categories that are protected by our current statutes. And what will happen is courts and administrative bodies will simply take that body of experience and apply it to this additional category of protection, which is sexual orientation, all aiming at the point that we are dealing with access to public education.
Thank you, Representative. And it is noted that it is sweeping in a whole other category.
Is this an additional question for the carrier?
I will have additional question for the carrier, please, Mr.
Additional
Speaker.
Question for the carrier. Does carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you. Also now then, when we talk about Section 22, which is at page 15, and that section deals with state personnel relations, that section of the bill in paragraph 2, section 22, requires the Department of Administrative Services to establish affirmative action to seek out underutilized members of protected minorities. Does this apply to Oregon's public school system? That would be at line 28.
Right. In fact, that subsection of the statute isn't the only amendments made to it are matters of form, changing a which to a that and a such to a the. So no change has been made by this bill. The earlier section, subsection, does add sexual orientation to the functions that are described in this provision.
Clarification, Mr. Speaker?
Clarification. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. And I just want to ensure you, I do understand that is current practice or current requirement under state law, but we are sweeping in another special category for consideration. So that's my probative question.
Yeah, the point I would reemphasize is that this is not an affirmative action provision. That is, it does not require the going out and seeking out or giving a preference in favor of people because of their different sexual orientation. This all goes to having an open opportunity for everybody. It's equality, which is the touchstone of this bill, and not preference.
Thank you. One last question, Mr. Speaker.
Another question. Is Kerry Yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you. So then, in the discussion of this affirmative action approach, which is already in current statute and sweeping in, as you say, this touchstone element, how will the state agencies verify that someone is indeed a member of that underutilized member of a protected minority to which we are now adding yet another category?
Well, I want to go first back to the premise of the question. As I said earlier, this bill does not provide for affirmative action, so there's no need to identify people who have different sexual orientation in order to give them preference, because this bill is about equal treatment. And in matters of employment, for example, or a public accommodation, or any of these protected categories, the burden of proof would be on the person who believes they've suffered discrimination to demonstrate that is in fact the case.
Clarification.
Does carrier yield?
So the demonstration is the affirmative action, and it's not a program?
No, I'm sorry. There's affirmative action is conventionally regarded as being giving a preference to people because of some characteristic. This bill does not provide affirmative action. It simply provides for equal treatment, and it allows a remedy, a legal remedy. People can bring a lawsuit if they feel they've been discriminated against and on various grounds, including employment. And they would have to make out a proof. They would have to carry a burden of proof to demonstrate that they have been discriminated against.
Thank you very much. To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I've heard some statements that really tend to divide those of us who believe this way and those of us who believe this way. Some of us in a community of faith happen to see it this way and not this way. Some of us believe that founding fundamental principles were not etched in clay. They were indeed driven into stone. Some of us believe that those things that we're talking about today cannot, in fact, be legislated. I remember in my wild and crazy liberal days, I used to join a mantra that said, you can't legislate morality. But by golly, here we are. We're doing that just that. The discrimination that we're talking about comes from the heart. And there is no ORS that's going to change that. I would like to share with you, reference has been made to a few weeks ago when there were people here testifying on both sides of this issue, a very passionate and personally held issue. A constituent emailed me and said, you know, my wife and I went down there and we wanted to sit in that room and listen to the testimony and even go up and testify. But they wouldn't let us in. They said, you have to go over there, which was another room. And then we saw a whole bunch of people in certain color shirt that went in, and they got to sit down. And I got the impression these people were a little elderly. So they were standing by the door, and as some people in the certain colored shirt went by, they gave them the salute, only it was the middle man standing tall. And I felt very badly, because these people were hurt. I suggest that's intolerance on the other side of the discussion. And I was hurt for them because they came as citizens of this state to listen and to have a voice, and they were, in fact, discriminated against. That's wrong, too. And that doesn't make it any more right from either side of the equation, but those are heart issues. And we can't legislate those. Respect and dignity of person should be something that we hold valued and true and dear, and we should not have to write a law about it. I have many friends. I have a family member who, looking back at it now, he died a few years ago, struggled through the silence. You didn't talk about being homosexual. You didn't talk about being gay all those many years ago. But I loved him. He was my brother. And I have utmost respect for my circle of friends who are gay. And Jerry and Rob, if you're listening, I love you. But I have to vote my value on this, too. And I will not be voting yes today. Thank you.
Further discussion? Representative Wisnett.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question of the carrier. Good representative from Lake Oswego.
Question of the carrier from Lake Oswego. Do you yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you very much. Good colleague, you held many good meetings and long meetings, and I was not able to attend all those. So I had just one question for you. The bill... SB 2A was requested by the Governor's Task Force on Equity. Could you, in their conclusion, they state adoption of the task force recommendations for law changes in Oregon will be just one step forward towards great societal changes and acceptance. My question is, was SB 2A designed to encourage tolerance from those with differing views, or would you characterize it as designed to require acceptance? Thank you.
Thank you, Representative, for that question. I actually did not serve on the committee on rules, although I sat in on some of their hearings, and so I'm going to yield this question over to the chair of the committee who participated in all of those hearings so that you can get the fullest kind of response.
Good Representative, could you repeat your question, please?
Yes, ma'am. The bill was requested, I think, by the Governor's Task Force on Equity. And in the conclusion of this task force, they state, adoption of the task force recommendations for law changes in Oregon will be one step forward towards great societal changes and acceptance. So my question is, was SB 2A designed to encourage tolerance of those with differing views, or is it designed to require acceptance?
Representative, it's the Governor's Task Force on Equality, I believe. And I would say that probably is not exactly the right choice. I think that what the bill is designed to do, which I think it does pretty effectively, is to prohibit discrimination in the categories that are spelled out in the bill. Now, perhaps as a consequence of doing that, It could encourage tolerance. It could probably also encourage acceptance, but I don't think that's directly what the bill does.
Further discussion? Representative David Edwards.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. To the bill.
To the bill.
Esteemed colleagues, assembled citizens, I will vote in favor of the landmark legislation before us today. My I vote is based on both my Christian faith and my understanding of our constitutional duties. I recognize others will vote nay for the same reasons. As the good representative from Clackamas County has already pointed out so eloquently, good people of faith can come to different conclusions. As we debate this important matter today, it is imperative we respect each other's points of view. To my mind, this bill represents an opportunity to renew our broken social covenant, a covenant based on a respect for law, but more importantly, on trust, affection, and love. The idea of a covenant is central to both prophetic religious traditions and our small R Republican form of government. It is a binding promise between people, a pact that provides for joint action or an obligation to achieve shared ends. Our social covenant means that together we are responsible for the character of our state. As I see it, my central charge as a public servant is to constantly renew the fundamental covenant that binds us together as Oregonians. And I believe the circumstances of the most vulnerable among us are always the best test of our covenantal faith. The biblical prophets remind us of our mutual obligations to each other and to a higher authority. They call us to return to our true selves and purpose, to remember who we are as the children of God. Fidelity to this notion is finally not measured by allegiance to any dogma or doctrine, or even by occasional social charity, but by the fundamental relations between people we affirm in law. The bill we vote on today is not solely or even primarily an anti-discrimination measure. It is a means to reestablish right relations with one another, to ensure the welfare of all citizens is the prime object of our government. Freedom from discrimination enables people to learn, work, contribute, and achieve. To be deprived of it is a kind of excommunication from society and its rewards. That is why I believe covenantal justice demands we pass this measure now. When it comes to basic rights, everyone should count with the same weight. For me, this principle, embodied in the legislation before us, is derived equally from the Code of Heaven and from our country's founding documents. And for our fellow Oregonians, it means a fair chance to make the most of their lives. I hope others will gradually see more and better judge the worth of those whom this bill will best protect. By voting aye, I strive to honor our sacred covenant and its inherent responsibilities. By voting aye, I intend to give conscience greater scope and liberty greater light. By voting aye, I mean to extend basic rights and protections for all citizens. For the sake of our neighbors, friends, and family members, I cannot wait any longer for some undeniable sign the time for discrimination has passed. In this moment, I am compelled to own up to God's love. After all, it owns me. Most of the time, we live by rote. We go about our routines as if carried by sheer inertia. This hour demands the whole of our attention. We have a truly historic opportunity before us, a springtime chance to reaffirm our social covenant, and at a higher level, the imminent and infinite and saving love of God. If, at the end of our lives, we are blessed with a clear...
Representative Meyer yields.
Thank you, Representative. If, at the end of our lives, we are blessed with a clear recollection of our past, it is likely only a few scattered moments will be singled out for their permanent or visible benefits. Together, these moments, crowded into the time they occupied, may equal weeks, days, or even hours. For me, there is no doubt this moment will comprise part of that brief but life-changing span of time. Now, humble before God, I hope to be equal to the biblical call, be strong and of good courage, be not afraid, neither be thou dismayed. And when I cast my aye vote, I will rejoice in the knowledge that I honored our social covenant and helped restore its rightful place in the order of things. I urge you to join me, and then each, according to our skills, can see to the speedy and effective administration of this measure.
Further discussion, Representative Hanna.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. A question of the carrier from Lake Oswego, please.
Question of the carrier from Lake Oswego, do you yield?
I do.
He does.
We can have a private conversation.
All right.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. It is my understanding under this bill that we have exempted religious organizations such as churches, church-sponsored facilities, faith-based hospitals from the provisions. On page 14 under section 3, subsection or section 21, subsection 3, a governing body may not hold a meeting at any place where discrimination on the basis of race, color, creed, sex, sexual orientation, national origin, age, or disability is practiced. This would appear to say that we can no longer have a public meeting in a church or the boardroom of, say, a Catholic hospital if they chose the religious exemption provision of this bill. Would that be correct?
Yeah, Representative, I think the question would be whether that church institution was practicing discrimination that is outside of the exemption that is allowed under this statute. If it is operating within the exemption that is allowed it, then I would not read Section 21 of the bill on page 14 as making that facility then off limits for the governing body of a public body to conduct a meeting there.
Clarification, please.
Clarification, does Kerry yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. The question does include those organizations that are exercising their religious exemption.
That would read on to the text that is actually already in the statute under that section, subsection 3, which is it's a qualifier. It says, however, the fact that organizations with restricted membership hold meetings at a place does not restrict its use by a public body if the use of the place by a restricted membership organization is not the primary purpose of the place or its predominant use. So it would seem to carve out a significant exemption for the access to those facilities.
Further question?
Further question, Mr. Kerry yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. Did you have this discussion in the committee, and do you believe that this bill had the intent that you would limit opportunities for public meetings in, say, churches or church-based health operations? I mean, was the intent of the bill to limit those meeting places?
That wasn't discussed. Representative, that was not discussed that I'm aware of, and I was at all the hearings in the committee.
Representative Rosenbaum, also under the rules of the House, I'll have to have you answer questions from your desk.
With my apologies to the Speaker, since I invited her to use mine.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Yes, Representative, the issue that you're raising was not discussed in our committee hearings that I'm aware of.
Clarification then, please.
Clarification to Representative Rosenbaum, to the Carrier. Yes.
Yeah, thank you. So though it may limit opportunities for public meetings in those type of facilities, you did not have that discussion in the committee.
Thank you, Representative. We did not discuss it, but I think that if you look at the preamble to that section that you're quoting from, which says all meetings of the governing body of a public body shall be open to the public and all persons shall be permitted to attend any meeting, clearly the purpose of this statute is to make sure that when we hold public meetings, all members of the public are permitted to attend.
Thank you. Further question of the carrier from Lake Oswego?
Further question of the carrier from Lake Oswego. Do you?
I do.
He does.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. As you read this bill, would you make the assumption that the locker room in a high school would be a place of public accommodation?
I think a locker room would be like a public restroom, and it is a place of public accommodation. And we already have gender-segregated facilities for that purpose. It has not proven to be a difficulty under existing law where we already have prohibitions on discrimination on the basis of sex. So I would expect that the same thing would continue to apply with this protection for discrimination on sexual orientation.
Thank you. Further question?
Further question? Do you yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. Under the bill, then, as described, that a high school locker room might be the same as a public restroom, would a transgender or cross-dressing, as an example, biological male, be accommodated for in a girl's locker room in a public high school?
I'm offering you an opportunity to my co-carrier to comment on this. Representative, sorry, we were having a little colloquy here on the side. Your question included two categories, and that's why we were trying to sort it out. Cross-dressing is one thing. That's when somebody from one gender dresses as the other gender, and that would not be protected here under this bill at all. Transgender is a term that applies to those individuals who have changed their gender from one gender to another. And when they become the other gender, then it would be appropriate for them to use the facilities that are consistent with being that gender.
Clarification, please.
Clarification, do you yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you, and I'm sorry that I confused two issues there. Could you then describe at what percentage of transformation one might be allowed to be accommodated for?
Representative, this bill doesn't address at what point a person makes that transition by being transgender, but there would be biological tests that would sort that out and determine when a person has made the switch from being male to being female or vice versa.
Thank you. Further question to the carrier from Lake Oswego, please.
Further question of the carrier, do you yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you. This bill does not prohibit an employer from enforcing an otherwise valid dress code or policy as long as the employer provides, on a case-by-case basis, for reasonable accommodation of an individual based on health and safety needs of that individual. Would you please help us understand what is reasonable accommodation and what type of health and safety needs would require reasonable accommodation?
The standard of reasonable accommodation is one that will be sorted out in cases over time by courts and by administrative tribunals, and so that's something that I think will be developed over time. Question of health and safety needs, I think that they're... I'm advised by the chair of the committee that actually the phrasing here, based on health and safety needs, was not discussed in committee. This is something that's been... this was a protective clause added to the bill to make it clear that there could be a valid dress code or policy. I mean, the main purpose of this provision is to establish that it is still appropriate to for in the employment setting, which is where I see this language here used initially, that an employer can decide how people are to be dressed in the workplace, and that this doesn't prevent them from applying those standards.
Thank you. Further question of the carrier, please.
Additional question of the carrier. Do you yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you, good representative. Page 14, section 20, subsection 2, some discussion there about Department of Corrections. Who would make the legal decision on sexual orientation within Department of Corrections?
This, like the rest of the bill, representative, provides remedies for discrimination. And the prohibition says that discrimination may not be made in the provision of educational facilities and services and recreational facilities and services to any person in the Department of Corrections institutions. So in that setting, it probably would go through whatever internal administrative procedures or grievance processes are available to inmates when they feel that they've been mistreated, if they are being discriminated against in these categories, that is educational services and recreational facilities.
Thank you. I'd like to clarify within that question, please.
Clarification, does Carrier yield?
Yes, I do.
Carrier yields.
Thank you again, Representative. And under those descriptions and going through that process, then would Department of Corrections be required to house transgender or gender conversion individuals in the domiciliary of their choice?
Representative, I don't see anything in this provision here which already exists in our statutes, that is, it applies to matters of race, religion, sex, marital status, or national origin. Anything that would deal with how inmates are housed, it refers to the provision of or access to educational facilities and services and recreational facilities and services. I don't see anything in there about how they're housed within the Department of Corrections. I do see a following section says this subsection does not require combined domiciliary facilities at the state institutions to which it applies, which is not changed from prior law.
Thank you, Representative. I'd like to clarify on that last piece, please.
Clarification, does Carrier yield? Does the carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you, Representative. Again, on line 22, as you mentioned, the subsection does not require combined domiciliary facilities at the state institutions to which it applies. And so if it doesn't require that, does it require them to house those trans or gender conversion individuals in the domiciliary of their choice?
Well, I think we're getting down into in this case, the guts of a provision that's not even being changed by this statute. That last sentence of subsection 2 is already in our statutes. These are matters that are going to be dealt with administratively within the Department of Corrections. They have an elaborate set of processes, as I know from my service on the Judiciary Committee, for dealing with these internal matters and the treatment of inmates. I think we can rely on them to do a good and effective job.
Thank you. Just one more follow-up on that.
Additional follow-up? Do you yield?
I do.
Did the committee have any discussions? Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Did the committee have any discussions with the Department of Corrections as it relates to this bill, or did they participate in the committee work?
To my knowledge, well, actually, I'll let the chair, my co-carrier, because she chairs the committee.
Representing Rosenbaum, do you yield?
I do.
She does.
And to your question, the answer is no.
Thank you. Further question of the carrier from Lake Oswego?
Additional question is if carrier from Lake Oswego yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you very much. On page 5 under section 8, there's a section, make any distinction, discrimination, or let's see here. Back to the glasses. Oh, in addition to the sexual orientation, the source of income piece has me somewhat puzzled. If we cannot discriminate based on source of income, how will we assure payment of property?
Representative, the source of income phrasing is already in the statute. You got it's something that was already there, and you see it was moved from line 41 to line 42. Has really, I think, nothing to do with issues of discrimination based on sexual orientation, so I think it's just not relevant to this bill.
Thank you, Representative. You've been quite kind. To the bill?
To the bill.
Colleagues, as you can see, many times we work on legislation that purports to do something quite good when, in fact, it simply hasn't been vetted enough to fully understand the ramifications. And those issues that have not been fully vetted only leave open more question. This bill, in my opinion, leaves open more question and creates more question than it actually solves.
Further discussion, Representative Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question of the good representative from Lake Oswego.
Question of the carrier from Lake Oswego. Do you yield?
Of course.
He does.
And thank you, colleagues. This will go quick because we rehearsed this. On page 2, religious institution, including but not limited to a school, hospital, religious camp, may prefer an employee of one religious sect over another. Then on page 3 of the bill, under the sexual orientation section, it does list expanded areas of nonprofit religious day centers, nonprofit thrift shops, nonprofit religious bookstores, so on. But nonprofit religious hospitals are not listed in that second section. Is this an oversight?
Thank you, Representative, and thank you for alerting me in advance. And actually, let me thank my colleague here seated in front of me, who also alerted me to several of his questions as well. The fact is that it was not an oversight, because what you see happening here in this religious exemption is that there is really a three-tier exemption. There's an exemption for employment that is directly related to the operation of a church or other place of worship that is within the church itself. Then there are several categories of nonprofit religious institutions, school, camp, daycare, thrift store, bookstore, radio station, shelter, which are also specifically identified. And then there's a broader standard in C, which refers to matters that are religious where it's an activity is closely connected to the primary purpose of a church or institution, but is not connected with a commercial or business activity. So the question would be whether the hospital was primarily a religious institution or whether it is providing a function or service to the public in general. And I think that hospitals are going to fall in that category, except for those things going on within a hospital that are specifically religious, for instance, the chaplain function within a religious hospital.
Follow-up question, Mr. Speaker?
A follow-up question to you.
I do.
He does.
So as example, does adoption of SB 2 mean that a Catholic hospital, say, for example, in Eugene, could refuse an employment to a Baptist or a Muslim under the religious clause, but not refuse employment to a gay or lesbian citizen?
There is a different standard carved out here for employment of one's own membership, and the standards would be so that one could favor a member of one's own religion in hiring within an institution, and that's covered by what's now subsection 4. But subsection 5 would carve out the standard or establishes a broad religious exemption for religious institutions, which would govern whether or not you could discriminate against people on the basis of sexual orientation. As to other examples of religious discrimination, that's really beyond the scope of this bill.
Thank you. Good reference, Mr. Speaker. Further question of the carrier?
Further question of the carrier. Does the carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
As the Boy Scouts of America are listed as an association, will this bill affect the U.S. Supreme Court ruling regarding membership in the Boy Scouts in any manner, in your opinion?
One thing I can say with confidence is there's nothing that we can do on the floor of this House that will affect the decisions of the U.S. Supreme Court. They interpret and apply the federal statutes and the U.S. Constitution, and we have no power to change those.
Thank you, Goodrich. Thank you, Mr. Speaker. One final question, Mr. Speaker.
Additional question. The carrier, do you?
I do.
He does.
And I apologize, but this is just a clarification. It was indicated earlier that government wouldn't be reinterpreting what is religious, but that with these new sets of standards, you discussed that, you know, judges are going to have to interpret this. There'll have to be administrative rules written. So I'm just seeking a little bit of clarification here. Who's going to write the administrative rules? And I assume this can, in fact, be litigated in court. So government, the judiciary branch, will be making determinations on religious issues. Is that correct?
Representative, in that sense, it's like everything else that we enact in this building. We are creating statutes, and those statutes have to be applied. They're applied by administrative people who work for our state in carrying out the things we do here, and they are interpreted when there's a dispute by the people who wear black robes in our courts.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker, and thank you to the good representative.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you. Question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier from Lake Oswego?
From Lake Oswego, yes.
Do you yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you. The proponents of the bill included gender identity as part of the definition of sexual orientation. Is there a definition in Oregon law for gender identity?
Not that I'm aware of.
Another question.
Additional question. Do you yield?
I do.
He does.
There's a definition from the Eugene Human Rights Commission research on gender identity, and they define gender identity to include any transgender individual who could be transsexual, have had surgery, cross-dressers, transvestites, drag queens, and drag kings and queens, and anyone who breaks gender boundaries, unquote. Would this be a definition we would use here?
Well, Representative, I'd go back to maybe a prior interchange I had, which is that there, when a person of one gender dresses as another gender, that's something different from people who are in transition, who are changing their gender biologically from one gender to another. So the fact that somebody dresses up in the clothing of another, of the other opposite sex, I think is probably does not bring them within this definition.
Further question or maybe clarification.
Clarification, do you?
I do.
He does.
I've looked up a lot of things on the internet, and gender identity most often includes those with or without surgery and cross-dressers, etc., and that is how gender identity has been defined in many situations. I'm just clarifying how it would be applied here if we don't have a specific statute defining it.
I'm told that there are medical standards for determining gender that have been developed under the Americans with Disabilities Act, and it's bodies of rules and inquiry that have been had pursued for other purposes that would be looked to in applying this standard in our statutes.
Further question.
Further question. Do you yield?
I do.
Carrier yields.
Under the definition of sexual orientation in the bill, it goes on to say, it says it means an individual's actual or perceived heterosexuality, homosexuality, bisexuality or gender identity, regardless of whether the individual's gender identity, appearance, expression, or behavior differs from that traditionally associated with the individual's sex at birth. Wouldn't you interpret that to mean that it could be somebody who looks like the opposite gender but really is a different gender than they appear?
Well, I'd go back to sort of the broader purpose of the statute is to prohibit discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation, and sexual orientation includes gender identity. So the person who's in transition is going to be protected from discrimination under the statute.
Okay. Further question?
Further question to you?
I do.
He does.
You said earlier that there was no upset in social order, and I'm just wondering if there are any studies or any studies that have determined this that can be cited.
Well, as a reference to my opening speech, and what I said was, from my observation, the social order in Lake Oswego and in Salem has not suffered as a result of providing this protection. And I have to confess that it's just a personal observation on my part, but from what I can tell, that seems to be the case.
Okay, further question.
Further question of the carrier, do you?
I do.
He does.
Even though sexual orientation is defined to include expression, appearance, etc., would SB2 make it illegal for a man using the public restroom to ask a transgendered person who looks like a man to leave the bathroom until she is finished?
I'd say all these distinctions are things that will be developed over time as this law is applied. What we have is a statement of principle that sexual orientation cannot be the basis for discrimination, and case-specific applications of it will develop over time. My personal view is that those cases will rarely be pursued because, in fact, these people will, as a matter of just common practice and courtesy, will resolve those kinds of issues.
To the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, I'm not used to turning that way, but this is a kind of a confusing bill, I think. Like was mentioned from the good representative from Roseburg, there are still a lot of questions, and we didn't ask a lot of questions in committee. It was mostly testimony. I was there. Senate Bill 2 is supposed to prohibit discrimination based on sexual orientation, but as we have heard, the definition is vague and will develop over time and will be interpreted by the courts. I can't wait. The definition is based on someone's real or perceived sexuality or gender identity. Since Oregon law currently doesn't define gender identity, it would be widely interpreted to include transgender individuals, transsexuals with or without surgery, and cross-dressers. These confusing gender definitions create all sorts of problems in the public and private sectors. I'll just give you two examples. First, public accommodations under Senate Bill 2. It's kind of an issue here because you can have the community swimming pool being forced to allow people who appear different than their real gender, biologically speaking. They would be forced to allow them to use the locker rooms, and if they questioned them, they could be open to a complaint or lawsuit. In real estate, under section, I believe it's section 8, subsection 6, it's current law, where you're able to restrict the use of your property to people of the opposite sex if you'd end up having to share bathroom or bedroom facilities, but there's no such protection or ability for an individual to say they didn't want to have a transgender person or person with a different gender identity, however we're fluidly defining this now, sharing bathroom or bedroom facilities. Currently also, I know we talked a little bit about affirmative action, but right now, certain employers are required to report to the government how many racial minorities, Caucasians, men, women, are employed for a period of time, and they have to keep a tally. If there was a man working for me who said, I feel like a woman, shall I count him as a woman on this report? And will these reports going to these agencies be correct? Will they be reliable? Just a question. Not to mention businesses getting hit with lawsuits and complaints if they can't figure out which of their employees are gay, which ones are transgendered, and so forth. We also heard that reasonable accommodation is going to be sorted out by courts. I serve on the committee which sent these bills to the floor, and I try to ask as many questions as possible, but there are still so many unanswered questions. And yes, there was a religious exemption put in the measure, and I'm of the opinion it is not strong enough. One last thing that really does bother me about this legislation is the education component. Now, despite claims from supporters, I believe this new policy will have an impact on our schools and our students. Schools are employers and will have to follow this new law. Teachers are role models and their practices will be watched by children. Which leads me to the larger question regarding the message the legislature is sending if we enact this law. Permission to use a visual aid.
Representative Thatcher asks for unanimous consent to use a visual aid. Is there an objection? Hearing none, please go ahead.
Thank you. These are the emails, not including anything I received in committee, but these are the emails I received in support of both the measure we heard earlier today and this measure. And these are the emails I received in opposition to the same bills I referred to. The message deals with what kinds of rights Oregonians have to be protected from discrimination.
Representative Thatcher, hold just a moment. Representative Nelson yields.
Thank you, Representative Nelson. There's a quote attributed to Martin Luther King Jr.'s niece, Aveda Scott King, in expressing the difference between civil rights and special rights when she said, While I've met many former homosexuals, I have yet to meet a former black. And finally, I have an email from a constituent in Kaiser. Said these bills use the power of the government to force societal approval of sexual conduct. I'm not sure that's something I want my government promoting. And I don't believe the vast majority of my constituents do either. Thank you.
Further discussion, Representative Gerard.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. I'd like to question the carrier, please.
Question of the carrier, does carrier yield?
I do.
He does.
As always, I'll be probably more brief than anybody else. The concern I have is on page 10 of the bill, lines 11 through 13 for starters. And just to read the part, the court may award reasonable attorney fees and expert witness fees incurred by a defendant who prevails only if the court determines that the plaintiff had no objectively reasonable basis for asserting the claim. For a layperson, would you please tell me what reasonable basis means?
Well, my principal comment about that language is that that is already in the ORS. That's not something that was changed by this bill at all. It's simply the procedures by which any of our non-discrimination protections are enforced. So there's nothing that's being changed by this bill at all in those provisions.
Further question of the carrier?
Further question of the carrier. Do you yield?
I do.
He does.
I understand that this is the language, but we're incorporating legislation into this. And so the line above that said the court shall award reasonable attorney fees to the prevailing plaintiff. So the plaintiff and the defendant are treated differently. And I have I'm confused as to why in any case that would occur as to how you get attorney fees.
Well, Representative, that's a policy choice that's been made in our statutes already with respect to enforcement of our civil rights laws and non-discrimination provisions, and there's nothing in this bill that makes any change in it. That's just the way our statutes work now.
Okay. I have no comments. I'm just really...
To the bill?
To the bill, and I'll be extremely brief on this. The bill, to me, needs to be rewritten, and a lot of these issues need to be addressed before we go forward with this bill.
Further discussion, Representative Olson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question of the carrier.
Question of the carrier. Does carrier yield? Which carrier would you like to speak to?
The carrier, actually the representative from Lake Oswego.
Carrier from Lake Oswego, do you yield?
I do.
He does.
Thank you kindly. I have two questions, but I need to kind of develop a little bit of a story and share with you a phone message transcript that I've given you, but also share with everybody here too, as well. And it's from a Candace Lazaro out of Washington County. She left this message on my phone. I'm not going to read it entirely so we can move through this quickly. But this is what she said, and she said this emotionally. I called earlier. I got a little hysterical over Senate Bill 2. I feel badly about that, but I need to tell you I have some really good reasons to be hysterical over it. My former husband is a transsexual, and quite frankly, the hell he put me and our son through was very real and very painful. And it really frightens me to think that Senate Bill 2 would make me a criminal for telling the truth about my experience and my pain. And it would make me a criminal, or would make a criminal act out of my pain and those people who helped me get through that. I don't believe homosexuals or people like my husband, that gender confused, should be discriminated against. I do not think they are a true minority either. Now I'm going to skip a little bit here. John Hopkins Hospital did a thorough study on the issue of transsexuals and transitioning, and they quit doing the sex change operations because they realized that it wasn't helping these people. And in fact, Senate Bill 2 would make this phone call a crime. And yes, I am very angry at what my husband did to me and my family, but I also have a lot of compassion for this man because he is a hurting man. And he is mutilating his body for a lie, and he is like... And if he is like other transsexuals like Renee Richardson, he will live to regret it. Renee Richardson did, the first man to have a sex change operation. Christina Jorgensen, he did it, and he regretted it. I just beg you to vote no against Senate Bill 2. So my first question of you then, Representative, is toward the top there, the writer of this mentioned, would make me a criminal for telling the truth about my experience and my pain. Would, in fact, what she's going through and what she's describing here make her a criminal?
Absolutely not. Okay. There's a lot of confusion that surrounds this bill because of people who feel strongly about sort of the underlying subject matter, but the fact is this is not a criminal statute, so nobody would be made criminal by anything in this bill. That's point number one. Point number two, this bill protects against discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation. So she would have to be, if she were the employer of the person and were discriminating against him, then that would be actionable under this bill. But otherwise, it has nothing to do with how her feelings in relation to a former spouse.
Okay. Thank you. Mr. Speaker, to the bill.
To the bill.
Colleagues, members in the chamber here, Mr. Speaker, it's important. Yep. The representative from Southeast and Northeast Portland mentioned at the very beginning of this that this is an emotional issue. Indeed, it is. The representative from Clackamas County, I would almost kind of term that as his sermon, what he was sharing, mentioned about the infinite nature of God's grace. To be truth with you, and I think many of you can concur with me, I am thankful for that grace. Having been through the Bible now on my 34th time, as one talks about God's grace, you can't help but not talk about the righteousness of God as well. Matthew 6:33, Jesus is talking on the Sermon on the Mount, and he says, "Seek ye first the kingdom of God and his righteousness." I'm not going to go any further there. But I do want to do a correlation with you with that thought. And it comes from 1 Corinthians chapter 6, 9, 10, and 11. "Do you not know that the unrighteous will not inherit the kingdom of God? Do not be deceived. Neither the sexually immoral, nor idolaters, nor adulterers, nor male prostitutes, nor homosexual offenders," doesn't stop there, "nor thieves, nor the greedy, nor drunkards, nor slanderers, nor swindlers will inherit the kingdom of God. And that is what some of you were. But you were washed, you were sanctified, you were justified in the name of the Lord Jesus Christ and by the Spirit of our God." So, I am opposed to discrimination. And I think clearly the majority of Oregonians are opposed to discrimination. My whole life, I feel like I have been battling and standing up for someone who has always been picked on or bullied. I can think of how many times through junior high and high school I stood up for somebody and ended up getting into a fight. Maybe that's what drew me into being a police officer later for 29 years. I don't know. But I do know one thing. I do not like discrimination, but Senate Bill 2, I think, is the wrong direction to be traveling. Thank you.
Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Question to the carrier.
Question to the carrier from Lake Oswego. Do you yield?
I do. I would draw your attention to page 20, section 29, which is an amendment of ORS 659-850, which prohibits discrimination in public education, institutes of public education. And subparagraph 2, where it says, and I'll delete the extraneous wording so that it focuses on my question, says, "A person may not be subjected to discrimination in any public elementary, secondary school where the school is financed by monies appropriated by the Legislative Assembly." So it's an anti-discrimination statute. And my question is, although we've been told that this doesn't deal with curriculum, the statutes deal with discrimination. If a school district provides sex education instruction that does not give equal attention to both homosexual relationships and practices as well as heterosexual relationships and practices, and an adopted child of a gay lesbian couple feels discriminated against because of the parent's lifestyle, it's not being equally represented, would not public schools teaching heterosexual issues and practices be required under the anti-discrimination statutes that will now be based on sexual orientation, be required to equally teach about homosexual issues and practices in sex education questions and courses?
Representative, there's nothing about this provision here that speaks to curriculum. So I don't see anything here that's going to require the teaching of anything in particular. This talks about access to public education, and the provision, which Section 2 is essentially not being amended. There's a form or style change being made there in that provision, but it's already existing law that says a person may not be subjected to discrimination within the institution. So I don't see that there's any issue raised by this bill with respect to that provision of the law.
Follow-up question?
Additional question? Do you yield?
I do.
I'm drawing your attention also on page 20 to Section 1, which does amend ORS 659-850, where it says that, it says, as used in this section, discrimination means any act that unreasonably differentiates treatment intended or unintended, and then so forth, and says it includes religion, sex, sexual orientation, etc. And so in the statutes where we're dealing with prohibited discrimination in public education in 659-850, and where sexual orientation is now included under Section 1, then Section number 2 says that there will not be any discrimination relating to, you go back to one, sexual orientation, and then section 3, which is also on page 20, states the State Board of Education and the State Board of Higher Education shall establish rules necessary to ensure compliance with subsection 2 of this section, then is it not reasonable for us to conclude that the anti-discrimination statutes relating to education, which now will be anti any discrimination relating to sexual orientation, would not allow the teaching of sex education for heterosexual activities and issues without, or if that kind of teaching would discriminate against similar teaching for homosexual issues and practices in public schools at the elementary and secondary school level?
Representative, I don't see why it would have any different applicability when we're adding sexual orientation to Section 1 than it does matters of race, color, religion, sex, national origin, marital status. And I'm not aware that there are any curriculum issues now under those existing protections, so I'd see no reason why we would imagine that adding sexual orientation to that list of groups that cannot be discriminated against would have any impact on curriculum.
Just one final follow-up question on that regard.
Follow-up question. Do you yield?
I do.
Carrier yields.
Certainly, protection relating to race and religion have no effect or influence in what is taught in sex education classes, but sex education classes focus solely, specifically, on sexual practices and issues. And so by adding sexual orientation as a protected classification, then, and by stating it in the anti-discrimination sections, would you not think that because that part of the curriculum which deals with sex would actually be affected by the addition of sexual orientation as in Senate Bill 2.
Representative, I don't see any reason why there would be any greater tendency for there to be an issue as to sex education when we add the word sexual orientation than there would when, from existing law, when we have the term national origin in the non-discrimination statute and we have classes on geography or history. I don't see the connection, and I've not understood that there's any obligation to handle the presentation of different national origins differently because they are a protected class in the statute. I see no reason why we would, by adding sexual orientation as a protection, we would have any impact on sex education.
Thank you. Why are we here today?
To the bill.
Why are we here today? I mean, is it to enjoy the faded tapestries in this hall? Why are we here today? Is it for entertainment? Certainly Salem has better entertainment than coming here and listening to this debate. Why are we here today to determine whether or not the power, the politics, the policy of the state of Oregon shall be used to enforce laws based on sexual orientation behavior. Now, we're not here to discuss whether the cause of sexual orientation is nature or nurture. I mean, we're not here to answer questions as to why identical twins, where one is homosexual, there's less than an 80% chance that the other would follow a homosexual lifestyle. Such questions are better left to the scientists and their academies. We're not here to debate or discuss or determine why gay men statistically have a much higher incident of abuse of children than do the general population of men. That's better left to social scientist academies. We are here to determine that whether or not it's appropriate for the government to use its power to enforce behavior relating to sexual orientation, not what led to sexual orientation. 25 years ago, I was a young attorney, had a law firm, in Central Point, and a lady came in response to an ad for a legal secretary, very experienced woman. I was young, she was middle-aged, very experienced, went through her resume. She had all of the qualifications to be an excellent addition to my one-person law firm. And yet she had this gravelly voice, and so as I'm talking to her, I said, you know, from the sound of your voice, I can tell that you're a pretty heavy smoker. And she said, yeah, well, I am, you know, I just can't quit it. But it won't have any effect on what I do here. And so I talked to her and I said, you know, I don't like being around, you know, in an office where there's smoke. It kind of makes me feel congested, and I don't like the way it makes my clothes stink when I go home. And so even though you're very qualified, I'm not going to be hiring you as my legal secretary. And she looked at me shocked. She said, that's discrimination. And I said, yes. I mean, it is discrimination. She said, that's against the law. I said, well, I mean, I am a lawyer, and I understand that there are protected classifications of certain behavior, such as race, religion, gender, but being a heavy smoker is not one of the protected classifications. It's a behavior. You choose to smoke, and I choose not to hire you because you choose to smoke, because I choose to have a smoke-free environment. Well, back then, this was a pretty radical position. Since then, the law would be supporting that as well. But anyway, she didn't get hired. I want you to know, if there was someone who came in, who came to work drunk, I would choose not to hire them because they are drinking, and I choose not to discriminate against them. I choose not to hire them for that. If they came loaded on drugs, I would again choose not to hire them. Although, we could line up 1,000 behavioral specialists and many scientists who would come in and say, those folks have no control over those addictions. And it would be unfair for someone who has proclivities and tendencies toward addiction, alcohol, drugs, tobacco. If they can't control it, then who would I be to discriminate against those behaviors? There is a difference between tendencies, proclivities, even if they are genetically involved, and the action that's taken upon them. Colleagues, we are about to pass a bill, those of us that vote in favor of it, although I assume that there will be a substantial number of us that will vote against it. And we vote against it for several reasons. But one of them is that...
Representative Kotek, for what purpose do you rise?
Point of personal privilege, Mr. Speaker.
Please state your point.
I would ask that the good representative from Southern Oregon be careful about making characterizations about my personal character in his remarks.
Senators.
No, I didn't.
Under the rules of the House, the comments made were not directed to any representative personally, but they are part of a commentary on the bill before us.
If anyone is a smoker here, I do not direct my attentions to you or anyone else who has behavioral aspects that could be affected here. My goal is to focus on the bill. Senate Bill 2.
Representative Kremel yields.
Senate Bill 2 is about enabling and requiring the power of the state government to enforce rights based on, and as we go to the very beginning of the bill, sexual orientation, which means an individual's actual or perceived heterosexuality or homosexuality, bisexuality, or gender identity, regardless of whether the individual's gender, identity, appearance, expression, or behavior differs from that traditionally associated with the individual's sex at birth. Colleagues, that is a very broad definition and very difficult to define. It is not in the best interests, in my opinion, for the state of Oregon to pass a bill that places and enshrines in civil rights a behavior-based orientation. And so, therefore, I would ask for a no vote on Senate Bill 2.
Further discussion, Representative Jensen.
Mr. Speaker, I respectfully request a call.
President Jensen.
Excuse me, Mr. Speaker. I request the to end debate. What's the word I want? Previous question. Thank you, Representative.
Representative Jensen requests to call the question. We do not have anyone else in the queue, if you wouldn't mind withdrawing your motion.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you much. President Rosenbaum, do you wish to close?
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Colleagues, I think this debate has ranged far, far afield from the original bill, and so I would like to clear up a few things that have been raised in debate. First, for those who complained that people were not treated fairly, I don't know if they were talking about our hearings, but I can tell you, I think anyone on the committee could tell you, that we had an absolutely even-handed hearing in which equal numbers of people were in the hearing room, equal numbers of people testified on each side of the bill, and we alternated back and forth. So if anyone feels they were unfairly treated, it is through no fault of our own. I also want to point out that the issue of hospitals was raised, and I can tell you that no religious hospitals that I am aware of are opposed to this bill. There were also questions raised about the definition of sexual orientation that is in this bill, and I can tell you that the definition that is in this bill very closely parallels definitions that are in use today and have been for some time in local ordinances, and they have not been causing problems, and they have managed to interpret these statutes as we, I'm sure, will be able to. And finally, for those who feel that we have not had enough discussion about this bill and that it needs more time, I would just say that, colleagues, it has been 34 years since this legislation was first introduced in this chamber. If 34 years is not long enough to talk about a statute before we adopt it, then I think there's something very, very wrong with the way we are operating here. That should be long enough. There's one thing that's very clear, and it has come out in this discussion, and that is that not every person in the state of Oregon is receiving equal treatment or being treated fairly. I wish it were otherwise. I'm sure you do, too. And we in the hearings heard stories from many of these people, stories from a gay man who was fired from his job because he was too gay, stories from a father whose daughter was denied lodging because she was a lesbian, or a student who was afraid to walk alone to class because of the attitudes of fellow students, or probably most poignantly, those parents who were not able to be in a hospital room with their own children because of their legal status. And I wish we could pass a law that would instantly change all of that. And I know that no law we pass here can completely change what's in the human heart or human behavior. But there is something that we can do here by passing Senate Bill 2, and that is to say that in the law of the land of the state of Oregon, as in 17 other states, it is simply against the law and unacceptable to take actions based on somebody's sexual orientation, just as we prohibit those actions based on their race or their gender or their religion. We can't ensure that we will never hear another story about harassment, insults, or violence, or even about discrimination. But we can guarantee that the veneer of state sanction will be stripped away immediately. Colleagues, together today we have the power to ensure that the next time someone is denied housing, denied employment, denied equal treatment, denied their humanity, that they will not suffer the indifference of the state of Oregon. Every day in our state, people, real people, are denied real opportunities based on their sexual orientation. Today we have the power to address that, and I believe we also have a responsibility to speak out, to say that we know it is wrong. But we are doing more with this bill than just making a statement. It's hard work to move toward equality, but it's also rewarding. We can't just flip a switch. We can't make intolerance disappear overnight, but we can provide real concrete protections for Oregonians trying to fulfill their basic needs like food, shelter, and work. And just as importantly, we can say something clearly to the next victim of discrimination, that Oregon is on your side. Colleagues, it's been 34 long years that this legislation has been heard, and today is the day. Today, on this 100th day of this 74th legislative session, colleagues, it is time. It is time that we speak out. It is time that we use our voice and our vote, and it is time that we pass Senate Bill 2A. Colleagues, I respectfully ask for a call of the House.
Representative Rosenbaum asks for a call of the House. She is joined by Representative Barker, Representative Barnhart, Representative Cannon, Representative Clem, Representative Escoval. The doorkeepers bar the doors, sergeant arms at 10, and the clerk will call the roll.
Barker, Barnhart, Berger, Beyer, Bonamici, Boone, Boquist, Bruin, Buckley, Burley, Butler, Cameron, Cannon, Clem, Cowan, Dallum, Dingfelder, Chris Edwards, David Edwards, Esquivel, Flores, Galizio, Garrard, Gelzer, Gilliam, Gilman, Gerard, Greenlick, Hannah, Holvey, Hunt, Jensen, Comp, Kotek, Krieger, Crummel, Lim, McPherson, Maurer, Minnis, Morgan, Nathanson, Nelson, Nolan, Olson, Reed, Richardson, Riley, Roblin, Rosenbaum, Schaffler, Scott, Shields, Greg Smith, Patty Smith, Thatcher, Tomei Wisnet, Witt, Mr. Speaker, not answering, Tomei.
All members are present. Those of the opinion that the Senate Bill 2A should pass will vote aye. Those opposed, no. And the clerk will open the voting system. I will remind the public why the vote's being taken, that expressions of support or opposition not appropriate inside the chamber. Thank you. Senate Bill 2A, having received a constitutional majority, is declared passed. Propositions and motions. First reading of House bills.
House Bill 3543, relating to climate change, appropriate amending to Glen Ridge. House Bill 3544, relating to public records.
Bills read first time or passed the Speaker's desk for referral. Second reading of House bills.
House Bill 5042 relating to financial administration of Secretary of State, appropriate money, and declaring emergency. House Bill 5050 relating to financial administration of Water Resources Department, appropriate money, and declaring emergency. House Bill 2240 relating to authority of State Board of Tax Practitioners, and declaring emergency. House Bill 2633 with relating to vocational rehabilitation services. House Bill 2891 relating to certification of labor organized by the Employment Relations Board. House Bill 2893 relating to mandatory workplace communication to employee and employers' opinions.
Bills read second time or passed the third reading. Consent calendar. Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended. The bills remain on today's consent calendar be carried over to its proper place on Wednesday, April 18, 2007. Calendar. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Third reading of House bills. Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended. The bills remain on today's third reading of House bills be carried over to their proper place on Wednesday, April 18, 2007. Third reading calendar. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Final reading, memorials and resolutions. Chair requests unanimous consent that the rules be suspended. The bills remain on today's final reading of memorials and resolutions be carried over to their proper place on Wednesday, April 18, 2007 calendar. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Bills, reports, and other business line on the table. First reading of Senate bills. Second reading of Senate bills. Third reading of Senate bills. Chair requests unanimous consent the rules be suspended. The bills remain on today's third reading of Senate bills be carried over their proper place on the Wednesday, April 18, 2007 third reading calendar. Is there objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Other business of the House. Other business of the Senate. Orders of the day have been completed. Announcements. Representative Barnhart.
Speaker, the House Revenue Committee will convene as soon as possible in our usual meeting room. I do expect some members to take a lunch break. We're holding hearings today, and I expect a number of witnesses, so the committee will convene as soon as we can. Thank you.
Representative Barker.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Veterans Committee, 2 p.m. today. Thank you.
Representative Riley.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Government Accountability and Information Technology, 2 o'clock. Thank you.
Representative Comp.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. House Subcommittee on Education, 2 o'clock. Be prompt. We'll start on time.
Representative Hunt.
House Democrats will caucus tomorrow after session.
Further announcements. Remonstrances. Representative Lim.
Thank you, Mr. Speaker. Today I got a call from California and also from the Portland area. We heard all the news that I believe is 33 young people were gunned down in the Virginia attack in East Coast. And what I found out, the person who did that committed act is a Korean American. And I don't know the person. But I will not apologize. It's a Korean American. Sorry.
I'm here with you. Okay. Love you.
Further remonstrances? Adjournment. Representative Jensen, 10 a.m. Wednesday, April 18, 2007.
Mr. Speaker, I move the House adjourn until 10 a.m. Wednesday, April 18, 2007.
Representative Jensen moves the House adjourn until 10 a.m. Wednesday, April 18, 2007. Without objection, the House is adjourned.